Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Deepest Law. The cigar today, Partagas D4, D4 Damager, with the ill behavior, power to the people. Did you know that that song was a kind of peon to Castro's Cuba? He was talking about Cuban cigars. D4 Damager, that's the Partagas. Power to the people, that's the communist slogan. With the ill behavior, and anyway, speaking of ill behavior, Simon, we were talking on air. You're feeling a bit better.
I thank everybody, yes, for their concern. I've managed to kick the street heroine. This time last week, I was like Robert De Niro in that final shot of Once Upon a Time in America, with the opium pipe in his mouth, his eyes glazed over, smiling manically. Since then, I've cleaned myself up. I've gone into rehab. I've done my book, My Drug Hell, and I'll be on Oprah's sofa next week, bouncing up and down like a maniac.
Unfortunately for our Port Film Co-op, who was always one of our early super chatters, he missed your Keith Richards impression off air. he's always fishing for Simon Roberts' voices.
I'm going to leave that till next week. I'll have to work on that a bit. Not as good as some of my others.
Anyway, Horace, how are you doing, sir?
I'm relieved because I spent the last week sort of a bit concerned about Simon. I know he said that he's not the type to get addicted, but everyone's going to say that, aren't they? But who played Keith Richards in Stella Street? I always thought that was a good Keith Richards.
Yeah, Johnny Depp basically plays Keith Richards in Pirates of the Caribbean, doesn't he?
No, you know Stella Street with John Sessions.
Wasn't it the League of Gentlemen guy? It was the League of Gentlemen guy, the skinny one from League of Gentlemen. Pemberton, I think.
Okay. Yeah, that was quite a funny Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, I thought.
Yeah. And they also had a David Bowie, I remember, didn't they?
Yeah, and Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah,
it was good.
Okay. I don't know if it was them, actually. I feel like it was, but maybe it wasn't. Something like Stella Street.
I remember it was, what was it? John Sessions, Phil Cornwell.
That's it, Phil Cornwell. I think he played Jagger.
He's the skinny one, tall, skinny one.
I think he played Richard, sorry, and John Sessions played Jagger, yeah.
Right.
Oh, my God.
John Sessions did a really funny Dustin Hoffman, I thought, as well.
Have you just learned that John Sessions is dead?
I just learned that Phil Cornwell...
Yeah,
is a different guy from the League of Gentlemen guy.
Phil Cornwell is the guy from Alan Partridge.
Yeah, that's right. He plays the Geordie guy, doesn't he? Oh, Mr. Partridge.
No.
Isn't that him? That's Simon.
The rival DJ.
Yeah. No, you're right. Yeah. You're right.
Simon Thompson or something is the. Yes. Is Michael. Yeah.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say Steve Pemberton was thin from the League of Gentlemen. He tends to be the slightly podgier one.
Well, who's thin?
Maybe you mean Mark Gatiss.
There's one who's like tall and lanky and skinnier.
That's probably Gattis.
Yeah, Gattis was in Wolf Hall as well, if anyone watched that.
Gattis. And I mentioned, didn't I? Do you remember I did that Hammer Horror stuff? Gattis is all over Hammer Horror extras as like an expert in horror for some reason.
He is. He kind of superseded Kim Newman, who used to be the thinking nerd's horror buff. Years ago, and he sort of is omnipresent now. The only person I respect from the League of Gentlemen, though, is Rhys Shearsmith, because I did that review of A Field in England recently, and he's actually a really good actor. He's a really good film actor, I realised.
Just before we get going here, first of all, I have foolishly left my ashtray across the other side of the room, which is going to be very annoying. And not being Mr. Tickle, I'm going to have to go and walk over there.
be great if it could be Mr. Tickle.
Rereading a lot of the Mr. Man stories, Mr. Tickle is an absolute menace. He's an absolute menace. I think that if he was around today, I think he'd get done, wouldn't he? I think he'd be another.
Without even doing anything, he'd be preemptively done, I think.
He's with Rolf Harris kind of.
Have they not expanded the Mr. Men stories? I think I was in a sort of charity shop the other day, like passing by the book section. There was a little kids section, and there were these little Mr. Men books, like Little Miss, you know, Feminist or something like that. They've done kind of an extended range now. Well, you know, it's the kind of retconning of the Mr. Man.
It's his son, Adam Hargreaves, who's carried on. I mean, he's been writing them since the mid-80s or the late-80s.
Yeah.
And he's like, and you can kind of tell, in the early 90s, he added a character called like Mr. Cool, for example. You know, he's kind of
totally missing the point.
Yeah, but to be fair, as far as I've seen, they're not that woke, the Mr. Men. He's kind of stayed true to, you know, Roger Hargreaves' tradition. Although they have, I think they've changed Mr. Uppity's name to Mr. Snooty for the American market, which is a terrible change. Terrible change.
Oh, no.
Do you think Roger Hargreaves maybe put some sort of ironclad clause in his legacy to defend, you know, the true ideal of Mr. Men? He foresaw that it could be turned into something really warped.
I think there was like a Little Miss Fat, or no, Little Miss Plump. I think they've changed her name to something else as well, to be politically correct.
Little Miss Ham Planet, yeah.
Little Miss Big Boned or something like that.
Oh, dear, yeah.
Yeah, and there's another, like, there's a deeper law change as well. Mr. Greedy's got a cousin or something.
Mr. Eating Disorder.
Like, who's called, like, Little Miss Fat or something. And that has changed to be Little Miss Greedy. So they have the same surname. That's a change. But hold on a minute. Let me go and get my ashtray.
Yeah.
There's a couple more little banter pieces. The banter assassins will be back.
I mean, the Mr. Men thing for me, it's sort of future proofed in a certain way, because what he did really was get people to kind of laugh at middle aged foibles. All the characters were kind of like people's parents, really. They were sort of just grumpy, mustachioed men who wanted to be left alone.
Mr. Bump was one I remember.
Yeah.
It was had a bandaged head. Mr. Tickle did seem vaguely sort of wrong and menacing he was my favourite one, because I love the fact that in his story he could reach downstairs and get... Well, I always thought it was strange. I think, as I remember, he got a biscuit, reached downstairs and got a biscuit out of the fridge, which was weird. Who keeps the biscuits in the fridge?
I keep biscuits in the freezer. I put all biscuits in the freezer. I like them chewy and crunchy. I put everything in the freezer, chocolate, biscuits, anything like that. In the fridge.
Okay, I'm not objecting to that. I put chocolate in the fridge. I have put chocolate in the freezer before, but just to cool it down quickly. But that is unusual. You have to admit that. Mm.
Because I'm quite nerdish and a completionist. Mm. I got AAA, like the box set, the Mr. Men box set, and the Little Miss. So she's got all of the books. Mm. But then they did like these annuals. Like there's a magic book, and there's another book, and where they collect tales, where they've got like the Mr. Men in various fairy tales, or then we've got the Mr. Men in kind of like extra stories that they did. Like they put out like other types of books over the years, and then they collected them in these annuals. Mm. And I was walking across a charity store, and I was like, oh, what's that book? That looks like it was published in 1997. I must immediately buy it. Mm. So I did. And in the kind of Mr. Men extended universe, It turns out that like Mr. Tickle's got like a serious problem, that he has a compulsion to tickle.
Yeah.
And in one of the stories, they like it gets like completely out of hand, and he psychologically breaks Mr. Happy. Right. Wow. Mr. Happy now. Mr. Happy is the happiest of all the Mr. Men. And he's just like, this is getting out of hand. Like he is driving everybody up the wall with his tickles, right?
It's like Rod Hull, he can't stop.
Yeah, I don't know, like, through this story, some fairy comes or something. Usually there's a wizard. But they punish it, like, they punish Mr. Tickle to have normal size arms. And then he gets, like, depressed, and then he's like, without my tickling, I can't do anything, it's not fair, and so on and so forth. And so by the end of the story, they make a deal with him where he can tickle people, but he's limited to just one tickle a day. Right, he can only do one tickle a day rather than his compulsive, like, tickling people all the time.
Because they don't want him becoming Mr. Kid's Playground. Yeah.
So, well, like, I assume he was tickling adults, but he was doing it involuntarily, right? Well,
even then.
Against their, But, I mean, so now that he's reduced to one tickle per day, you've got to have oversight, right? So now you've got a board of tickle observation, you know, off tickle or whatever.
The oversight is that the magic will shrink his arms to normal size.
Subsumed to the managerial
regime. Oh, it's done by magic.
Yeah.
There's a lot of magic Deus Ex Machina endings to Mr. Men stories, I've noticed. And also the wizard is... I've noticed that in the early tales, the wizard is quite variable. But after a while, it formalizes into this kind of quite rotund, bespectacled, bald wizard. He's always the same fat, bald wizard in the Mr. Man.
Like Dr. Beeching sort of character. Like.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that is, but he is. He's kind of like a jolly professor type. Anyway, one of the reasons that I'm delayed, gentlemen, is because I had the idea of doing more filmings, doing more camera stuff this morning. And unfortunately, the little nut for my camera that I was going to put on my camera stand got stuck, right? The nut got stuck on the screw. Mm. And then the thread from the camera had come unstuck from the camera and was stuck on the end of the screw. Right now, and I tried using a spanner. I tried using my blowtorch lighter here to use heat. Mm. In the end, I had to give up, and I went down to B&Q, and a kindly B&Q assistant, who was an older gentleman called Fred, he was like, "Your problem is you haven't got the right tools." And then, you know, one of those moments where. Like a handy guy just makes you look like a right idiot there and then. He was like, "Yeah, jobs are good." He got the two things off, quick as he liked, because he had what he had is one of those spanners where you can adjust, you can tighten it with a separate, with a separate thing down the handle. Not even a normal spanner, like a really tight grip spanner that he had. Mm-hmm. And then he was able to do it with a large. So anyway, he got it off, and I had to then set it with super glue. And currently, it's being set with super glue. And after that's done, I may be able to record with this camera stand that I bought ages ago. Because a lot of people said, "Oh, it's good that you're doing it on camera, but you've got the angles wrong. It's too low down." I was like, "Well, I've got this camera stand. Like, well, maybe I'll use that." You know, so. That's why I'm late. Anyway,
I like to think he had a sort of avuncular manner, older middle-aged man, and he was wearing a brown shop coat, like people would have worn.
Yeah, he was, and he had a. In fact, he was very much like a character out of the Mr. Men, Fred.
Yeah, yeah.
Although he's in Mr. Men, he'd be called like Mr. Chips or something. You know?
Sounds like the last helpful person in England. Actually, I was speaking of which, I was laughing at your story yesterday about Hammersmith Bridge on Office Hours. Yeah. About the fact that the two councils can't actually work together to sort it out. Then even if they could, they couldn't get the people to actually fix the bridge. And even if they could do that, the people in the local area, because of the demography, wouldn't care. Sort of sums up.
I had a couple of little interactions with him because I was very grateful to him. I was like, "Thanks, you've helped me a lot, actually," because I didn't have to buy those tools or anything. And then when we were trying to figure out like which way round it went, he was kind of coaching me, almost like a kind of like a football coach or something. He was like, "Left to right, left to right." You know, he was kind of giving little helpful hints that I got it the right way round and that I unscrewed it correctly. And he was like, "No, when you do this now, make sure you don't get the glue in the middle, otherwise it'll be stuck there, you know. Check the instructions." Oh, he was fantastic. Hats off to Fred. He was a great guy. So,
opposite of everything curries stand for. Or
yeah, the exact opposite. B&Q is the exact opposite of curries. And B&Q don't have any curries-style staff members. And incidentally, Simon, that curries of the stories from months ago is literally next door to that B&Q. It's in the exact same place. So it's clearly like, there's a deliberate hiring strategy from both companies. So anyway,
fantastic.
The other thing I just wanted to
big F in the chat for Fred, please, everyone.
Well, he hasn't died.
No, this is the one. This is the one. Okay, one use when you can use F for something else.
The other thing I just wanted to mention really quickly is that just before we came on air, I did a pile of polls asking whose stock has fallen most. And I was kind of interested by the variance of the answers here, right? So I gave four options. I gave Jordan Peterson, Douglas Murray, Ben Shapiro, and James Lindsay. And then I asked people whose stock has fallen most, taking their whole output into account, who is the absolute worst, and then overall, who is the closest to being a net positive. What was interesting to me was that in terms of whose stock has fallen the most, Jordan Peterson stormed it. He was by far the most popular answer with over 50% of all the votes. Then who was the absolute worst? James Lindsay was the majority.
Easy one, yeah.
Shapiro was second, right? And then overall, who's the closest to being a net positive? By a country mile, Jordan Peterson won by 60%, with Douglas Murray in second at 28%. What interested me there was that clearly the people who follow, you know, the 40-odd thousand people who follow me on Twitter, or at least the ones who took the time to answer those polls, they clearly, like, value Jordan Peterson, or they've got, like, Jordan Peterson seems to have residual good feelings from people, yes. Whereas nobody expects anything from Shapiro. They know what he is. They know who he is. He's always been scum. Lindsay's just seen as a bit of an idiot type thing. And Murray was basically an also-ran in all of these polls. Although he did come second on the... Murray was kind of in the middle on all of these polls. So I just kind of found that interesting. I was wondering if I asked you two the same questions, how would you answer them? Like, whose stock has fallen the most?
I said Douglas Murray only because of the availability heuristic of the fact that he was recently, you know, in the conversation because of the road.
You're already out of date, mate.
Yeah.
Jordan Peterson had a debate against 20 atheists or something.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently beclowned himself in that debate.
Oh, no. I certainly agree with him, you know, people, as you say, having residual loyalty to him. I thought that was a very interesting thing, that he is seen as a sort of fallen icon. Maybe people feel somewhat poignantly that maybe he could be rescued.
There's a perception that Peterson has helped masses of young men, isn't there? I don't know whether true or not, but a lot of people still say that right now, even after he's embarrassed himself.
I think
Peterson began to discredit himself quite a few years ago as well, like to the extent that he has. I remember in 2019, he was going through that serious drug addiction withdrawal, and he was becoming quite strange then and looking strange and looking, you know, like he might die and stuff. He's been on and off since then. But Murray still had a lot of what credibility Murray had, he still had until just a few weeks ago.
Didn't he disappear off to Russia as well? To get Murray. Treated for his benzos.
Peterson.
Yeah.
Probably, yeah.
It's almost like a sort of Cold War story from the 60s. And then he disappeared off to Russia for a few years before.
Murray's got something like that, because a lot of people really rate that book about the strange death of Europe. They still think that that's like a really helpful red-pilling book to loads of people. But Murray has always been... The scumbag he is now, he has always been, I think. I thought that book was shit.
But it was very influential. It certainly sobered me in a very direct way.
I will say the Strange Death of Europe was red-pilling to me as well, because I remember I was listening to the audiobook of it, and I remember having to stop and pull over because I was so angry at some of the stuff he was talking about. You know, like, because if you weren't into the immigration as an issue, that was the first book that I read that took on the economic argument, for example, where he's saying, like, there's a whole section of that book where he's like, yeah, all these economic arguments for immigration are shit. And then he goes one by one, Murray kind of takes them down. But then there's that whole section on was it the island of Lampedusa?
Yeah.
And how, you know, Soros's involvement and all of that. Mm. All of that stuff was, like, you know, pretty good. when it was written, what, like 10 years ago now? So I remember that being influential on me. But I think also Murray is further to the right than Peterson in the perception, right? So he's more obviously a right winger, right? Whereas Peterson, in my mind, has always been this kind of like a psychologist who kind of tells you to clean your room type thing. Rather, so that kind of surprised me a little bit to see Peterson is still has that residual respect in a way. I just wonder what it's based on. Is it just the psychological help that he's given people to, you know, clean your room and stop wanking?
Without being disparaging, I think it's very similar in a way to the way people regard Carl from previous history, because I know he cops a lot of flack about, you know, he's still in 2016 and all of this stuff. But I mean, he does, as it were, undergo a journey and visibly change his mind over time about things. And you know, there is a lot of, for me, not for my generation, I think it was for people who are sort of millennials, a bit younger than me, who stood with Carl, you know, way back Gamergate days and continued with him. And he kind of brought them up in a way. So there is a reason why he has such a strong loyalty. You know, even if people might vary with some of his or differ with some of his opinions over time. But yeah.
How would you two answer the other two questions? Who is the absolute worst out of the four of them in your view, Horace?
Lindsay.
Who was the fourth one? It was Lindsay and who else?
Shapiro, Murray, Peterson.
Well, Lindsay is the one who's like, I swear all Lindsay's engagement just comes from us lot, from our side. I swear he would not be getting any engagement on Twitter or wherever if it wasn't for Dave, Carl, you know, Dave Green, Carl, and a few other people constantly engaging with him. I saw yesterday what I think is a big mistake. Carl was arguing with Lindsay about the free market and liberalism in that sense and all this. So that's not like Lindsay's not a worthwhile philosopher to engage with. And that's not the point of the woke right thing. It's not genuinely against, it's against white people and it's in favor of Israel. That's what the woke right thing is all about. That's what Millennial Woes did a really good essay on last week, or the week before. I think Lindsay is the most intellectually worthless, but Shapiro is probably the lowest low life because he's the epitome of what Zionism is. It's ethno-nationalism for his tribe and multiculturalism for us.
People were saying, like, actually, Shapiro's got the big, like, a more justifiable reason for being the way he is than any of the
justifiable.
Other countries. Yeah, because he's just, like, you know, looking out for his own interests type thing.
Yeah. Seeing whereas it from his point of view, yeah.
Whereas the other three don't even have that reason. And Lindsay, I mean, let's not forget that James Lindsay earlier this year or late last year accused Aaron McIntyre of trying to summon fucking Araman.
From Warhammer 40K as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that is...
It's just theatrically awful.
Those guys, like... I would just say, like, Lindsay, Joel Berry, Wokal Distance, all that, they're not worth engaging with as philosophers. They're like, and their position as...
I'm surprised you use the word philosopher, to be honest.
But as in they talk about the subject philosophy, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, it can be a compliment, philosopher, because it does actually mean seeking truth, doesn't it? Which they're not. But those guys, anytime they're asked, does all this woke right stuff apply to supporters of Israel? They simply refuse to engage on that question, to answer that. So they are knowingly lying to everyone and hypocrites. So in that sense, they are the absolute lowest lowlifes. But Jordan Peterson and Douglas Murray do the same. They will not engage on that question. So yeah, I suppose in that sense, yeah, Shapiro is better than all of them. I want to say
who
Shapiro
is the closest to being a net positive in your view? Peterson got over 60% of the vote, by the way.
Peterson, because I don't disagree with him on everything, but I disagree with the others on virtually everything. Peterson does have, yeah, like some conservative values in some sense.
Your view?
Same. I mean, it just all went wrong after he started taking the benzos, you know, for him. I think there was a point of trying to pick young men up from the slough of despond, and getting them to at least look at the reality of their own lives and begin to make concrete changes. Because that, I mean, certainly for me, is the only way things ever happen. You know, people for too long were living in a kind of world of magical thinking, waiting for a sort of epiphanic moment where, you know, God would smile at them through the clouds and fix all of their problems. And Peterson did give that sobering message of, no, you've just got to crack on, start using concrete action to improve your life, and then the emotional stability will follow. And I think that's a useful lesson.
I also think his stuff about the lobster, right, the hierarchy, like his insistence that human beings are hierarchical and all those sorts of things, are actually deeper red pills than they seem. Especially if you're coming from a place of like blank slateism or leftism or something. Peterson in a way goes underneath in a way that, like, Douglas Murray is quite a surface level thinker. I mean, even in Strange Death of Europe, do you remember that whole chapter about the feeling that Europe is tired?
Yeah.
What the fuck is that? What does that even mean?
What is that?
The thing stayed with me from Peterson was the thing he talked about rats, you know, the big rats playing with the little rats, and the big rat has to let the little rat win the play fight, you know, 15 to 30% of the time or whatever it is, in order to stay moralized, you know, as a control mechanism. That was an interesting analogy.
I also have to say that Peterson has provided me with many, many clicks when I did that whole exercise. Remember he wrote the Conservative Manifesto? That was the biggest load of gobbledygook I've ever read. It was just terribly written. And I'm pretty sure I sold a lot of foundations of writing on the back of my kind of trying to rewrite that. You know,
you were very exercised by that, weren't you? It was a couple of streams at least, wasn't it?
I think it was like three or four streams on not correcting Peterson, but translating it into like legible plain English, because... that was awful. That was one of the worst things he's ever done. But
Only equivalent in spleen to the Labour Manifesto stream, I think.
Oh, yes.
James Lindsay did a book called, was it Race Marxism? I read a couple of left-wing reviews of that, like Marxists' reviews of that. And the reviews were clearly better than the book. It was really funny. Like Lindsay's so bad that he's beclowned by the left, like by the hard left. But yeah, like... I've seen Dave Green, he did, I think it was on Benjamin Boyce's channel, did like a four-hour debate with Vocal Distance. And just like clear who's talking more sense. But I just think it's a mistake to treat these guys as sincere. They're not. If they won't answer that question about Israel, they're just lying. They're not against identity politics. They're not against collectivism. They're just against white collectivism. That's all it is. And they're just servants of the existing power. And that's that. If they won't answer it, they shouldn't be engaged with, and they won't answer it.
That unprincipled exception, or the Schmittian exception in Peterson, has always been his weakest point. And I remember guys breaking that down. I'm trying to remember who made it. It was a Gangbusters video back in like 2017-18, where was it Woes or was it Devon Stack, or I can't remember, but it was like called The Trouble with Jordan Peterson. And it was just that, basically pointing out all of the times that he answered those two questions differently. And it's like you cannot talk about logic and then have one exception for no reason, because it's special pleading, basically.
And I hate all the passive people who let them get away with it, who just let them avoid that. It's like they are skewered permanently on that question. Anything else lets them off.
To be fair, they haven't. I mean, Dave Smith is actually. Tucker Carlson and various other people.
Which is good.
You know, I mean, okay, you could say, well, they're doing it so that it's them and not you, say, right? You could make that containment argument. But I think the bottom line is it doesn't really matter, because the actual argument is cutting through in a major way. So I don't know. Anybody who's watching this, if you want like a dedicated video on those four, because I think it's fascinating to see how things have changed in a way. Because if there's one thing that has changed, it's that the IDW have really been exposed. I mean, I used to write for Quillette back in like 2018, 2019.
Shame.
And, well, I mean, I remember taking a conscious decision to not write for them anymore. Because I could tell they were going in like a shit direction, basically.
Yes.
And And I'm glad to see that my kind of instincts were proven right in the long run, because a lot of those people from that sphere have ended up in this kind of weird lol cow bucket, really. Yes. Because they're being like, they've been left behind by both the right and the left, really. Like, nobody occupies that. So even the Labour Party, right, the UK Labour Party, is now like positioning themselves to the right of where they are, if that makes any sense. So, yeah. You know. Anyway.
Yes.
Bitter Lake. Where did we get up to?
27 minutes 50, I think, was about where the British are coming in 1964. Oh,
27:47.
There you go. Bad, is it? Perfect timing. Before we jump in this week, I just want to say I posted up an essay from Adam Curtis's old blog, The Medium and the Message, his series Kabul City Number One, about it's really an essay about the failure of pop music to take root in Afghanistan. I just want to give you just a quick burst of the intro from the essay, because it's a really interesting piece. He talks about how in Kabul they had the first rock festival in 1975. And then he says, at the very same time in New York, a group of renegade Democrat supporters were meeting. They wanted to find a way of alerting a sleepwalking America to the immediate threat from the Soviet Union. Many of them saw themselves as a new movement, and a cynical journalist had given them a new name, neoconservatives. But they had decided that they rather liked that. They agreed to set up a pressure group called the Committee on the Present Danger. None of them could have imagined that within 5 years, they and their ideas would become one of the main influences that led America into its first military intervention in Afghanistan, supporting the Mujahideen. One of the leaders of the group was a neoconservative called Norman Podhoretz, and the thing he hated most was rock music. So that's quite a hooky intro there to whet your appetite.
Sorry, was he friends with Doug Morris?
Not that I'm aware.
By the way, on the Doug Morris thing, I have my reply to Andy Edwards going, I think that drops tomorrow morning. So if you want to see my reply on jazz, hip hop, Doug Morris. I'll be replying to him. I've also just seen something unrelated. I was closing my Twitter and it cropped up at the top of my feed. A Labour MP has used the term Boris Wave. Oh. So that is quite unprecedented, because Boris Wave was a term started in, let's face it, our corner of the internet, you know. Yeah. Not by it.
Nigel Farage will never do so.
Yeah, I think, was it Drupka or was it Matt, our buddy Max Simon? Who coined Boris Wave?
Yeah, it would be in the Drukpa sphere, I would confidently say. Yeah, it was certainly a coinage. I can't remember who exactly, but I notice it's actually activating and aggravating a lot of Corbynista leftists. I saw some notes last night raging against Boris Wave, because it's obviously become a very effective term and it's landed mainstream. So not much they can do other than bang their fists in misery.
They are really fighting the realization that they are now defending Boris's policies from 2019 and 20 against. Yeah, I can't even figure out the entanglement of it, but they are defending the Tory policies of 5 years ago against Labour or something. I don't even get what's going on.
It's so bizarre. I mean, when Scrump and Evelyn talked about the switcheroo a couple of years back, nobody expected it to be to this extent. I mean, it's gone. It's kind of crazy. So you got leftists defending Boris Wave now, Horus.
It's bizarre.
And they don't like the term. I thought they loved it because they could pin it on Boris.
Because they are defending it, and they don't want to acknowledge that they're defending Tory policies. That's the last thing they want to admit. Right? Yeah.
There was one guy last night who was absolutely furious about, oh, Boris Wave, shut up. UK, shut up. They're hating the memeage.
Who was that?
I'll find the link and I'll send it to you later. It was just some rando sort of Corbynista leftist. But, you know, one of the ones who, if he could, you know, they'd kill you. Those kinds of, you know.
They are impotent, though. It's a really pathetic position they're taking. It's like, yeah.
Well, they've been purged.
People to the left of Navarra, you know.
Yeah, I watch the guy, Damo Kerno, a guy from Cornwall. I watch him sometimes just to get that, you know, to get that side of things. And yeah, he's just doing, he's just trying to make what he thinks is a principled argument in favour of care worker visas. But it's not. It's just a Tory policy from 5 years ago. That's all it is.
Yeah.
And he wants it to be something better.
I watched Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart this morning just to catch up on the rest of his politics, because their thumbnails are like, oh, Labour is wrong on immigration, or is Labour a right-wing party now? The thumbnails are clickbait. If you actually listen to it, they both agree that immigration is too high and needs to be reduced and so on. Campbell is just kind of like, Campbell was saying, like, with this issue, you need to show and not tell, right, rather than engage in rhetoric. Because his argument is, if Starmer doesn't live up to his hype, Farage is going to have him on toast, right? Because if you disengage in rhetoric and then you don't deliver the goods, nothing's ever going to be good enough for reform. So in Campbell's analysis, Labour on hiding to nothing no matter what on this issue. So instead of making a song and dance about it and making it on the issue on which you're judged, just do a quiet and effective job through policy and talk about other stuff would be Alistair Campbell's way of going about it, which was an interesting insight.
I reckon he's wrong there. I reckon the thing is to make a big show of what you're doing, regardless of whether there's any substance to it in this instance. But you don't have to think much about Farage, because Farage doesn't want to deal with immigration. He doesn't want to be an anti-immigration party. He wants that issue to go away. If it was up to him and Tice, they would not even have a policy of stopping the boats, let alone reducing, let alone stopping, let alone reversing immigration. They don't. They are more pro-immigration than Starmer, like, genuinely. They really are. It's amazing. Like, reformer of poison. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, let's get back to Bitter Lake. The banter has started to invade the actual analysis, Simon. But anyway, yeah. Let's get back to it.
The British Board of Trade, in the booklet it gives out to visiting British businessmen, does try to be helpful. But this is what it says about Arabic time, and that's only one of them. Sunset is taken as zero when watches are set to 12. A business appointment given for, say, 2 o'clock in the evening will therefore be for 2 hours after sunset. And for 5 o'clock in the morning, 7 hours before sunset. It's important to remember that sunset should be regarded as midnight. The time of sunrise is irrelevant.
Well, I don't know about you, but I know sun time is roughly 6 hours plus five. In other words, it's either 11 o'clock, morning or evening.
But which? Is it
11 o'clock.
But it must have some relevance to the time of day. How do you as a businessman make appointments?
I normally make them by my watch. I ask them personally whether they are conforming to either Arabic time, sun time, or GMT plus three. They normally say the other two. I ask them to give me a time at GMT plus three. Now, sun time is 6 hours after this, roughly.
6 hours after that?
You are 6 hours plus five, give or take an hour.
Do you know what time it is now?
Not really.
In 1964...
Well, what was all that about? I don't... Is that true?
The time reckoning. Well, I know from experience when I used to run a private medical practice that whenever I had to deal with patients from Saudi Arabia, it was a nightmare trying to get them to do anything, because you usually do things like appointments or tests in the morning, and you could never get them out of bed before about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So, yeah, but the guy reminded me of, he's like, the guy in the Farce show in the pub, you know, who tries to work out people's change, and he makes it inordinately complicated, you know.
And he ends up chucking the big change jar on the floor and goes, down.
There's a different time happening. Yeah.
I ran a central banking event in the Middle East once. Oh. Where I was a producer on it. And you'd think now, so we were having like central bankers from all over the Middle East come to speak at this event. Absolute disaster, because people didn't turn up, they were 3 hours late. they were so blasé about, like, it was like, yeah, there's nominally an event going on, but like the program, the timings, forget about it. It was basically impossible to run that event.
Yeah.
You know, but people calling on the day just saying, oh, yeah, I can't bother to come now. It was like, you're the keynote speaker, what the fuck? So yeah, that was a disaster, that event. I remember.
Even parts of Europe are somewhat like that. Like Southern Europe is much more relaxed.
The French were like that. The French were like that, in my experience. But the Germans, bang on time.
Different matter, yeah.
Bang on time. You know, in fact, the Germans would be checking their watch. A bit late, aren't you? You know, they would be checking on you, you know. Whereas the French were very, very blasé as well. They were better than the Middle East. They were better than that event in the Middle East was one of the all time, you know, and I will give it to Americans, right? The American says he's going to be there, he'll be there. But not so with the Arab, I'm afraid.
No, punctuality not a priority.
As they're referring to it as sun time, I'm assuming these are practices from before it was common to have a watch or a clock, right? And they just haven't really taken on the implications of the new technology. Right?
I'm just,
70s, right?
The whole cosmology of life in the Middle East, certainly in Saudi Arabia, does seem to be skewed. One of the problems we had was you could never get the birth dates off the patients because they didn't know what day they were born. So when we had to register patients on systems, they'd give you their birth date. Lots of them would give you their birth date. It was 1st of January 1900. Because that's how they were kind of registered everywhere. They just didn't have concepts of obviously.
But I'm surprised the British hadn't imposed universal GMT time on the entire world, so that in the Middle East they would be like, well, it's GMT plus five or whatever. What they were saying is that at the local level they just still do it by the sun or some bullshit.
Yeah, they're GMT plus 3 or 2 hours in the case of now British summertime. Ahead of us,
but they don't go by that. They go by midnight or something.
But I'm guessing
they don't care so much.
When Britain was in charge of Kuwait and Bahrain and stuff, I'm guessing those places did run according to British time. But culturally, there's a strong resistance to that. But I think when like Americans and Brits over decades have tried to create really solid functioning armies out of Saudi and other places, right? And armed forces, and just can't do it for various like tribal and cultural reasons. Just loads of things cutting across what ought to be the chain of command, right? Like, I'm not taking orders from that guy. He's from the wrong tribe. So it just doesn't happen. I can imagine you trying to put together a conference. It's the same thing. You don't want to be seen to get there 2 hours before guys from the other country or the other tribe and be waiting for them. That's low status, you know?
Yeah, well, I was mental. I tell you what, I mean, the event I did in India as well, in Mumbai, at least the Indians were there and on time and so on. But that was its own kettle of fish. I remember there was this, I told this story before, Simon, meeting this one Indian guy. And you know when they shake your hand? And he was just fucking squeezing it.
Yeah.
It's like, you're going to let go or what? No, you're just crushing my hand. What the fuck are you doing? Just wouldn't let go. And then later on, in that same day, I'm sure I told this story before, that same guy who did that, I was coming out of the loo, slapped my ass. Oh, I tell you what, if I hadn't been working, I would have lamped him.
Psychological games. It ties in with something.
What the fuck? I mean, see, I honestly had to exercise self-control.
Yeah,
I didn't lose my temper or whatnot, but you know, he was asking for it. That guy.
These were Indian guys. You're saying
he was an Indian guy. Yeah,
yeah. I just want to reference Nick Dixon's podcast this week. He was talking to Liam Halligan, the economics correspondent, very well informed guy, and he was talking about how the current issue with negotiating trade deals is. That Keir Starmer pulling off the one with India was quite something because the Indian trade negotiators are extremely tough. Play a lot of psychological games, and the British haven't had practice since being in the EU all of those years of getting trade delegations together with a kind of robust approach to the Indians, who are pretty chess player
I should have just gone in. I just should have gone in hard on him. I should have just been like, listen, all you are is an Indian IT cybersecurity engineer. You're not all that. How about fuck off? But no, I was professional. In fact, I was too professional in that job. I'm thinking back, I should have. That was one time. Yeah, and the other time was when I was in New York. Remember, I told that story before as well. Mm. I was in New York. The guy with the big handlebar moustache talked for me on a number of occasions. He talked for me in Chicago. Big market data guy, you know, and sat down. You know, the event was due the next day. I was like, right, okay, let's go for a drink or whatever. So, you know, opening line, straight in. I want to suck your dick.
Sorry, was this guy wearing like a leather bike?
No, he was just dressed in normal, just a normal suit, normal professional setting.
It's a psychological destabilization gambit. Yeah,
yeah. Opening gambit. Now, I had a wedding ring on, right? I was like, I'm straight as an arrow. I was like, I'm straight as an arrow, mate. So you probably got the wrong guy there. And he was like, "You're making me so hot right now." I was like, "Fucking hell!" What?
Sorry, this is part of a negotiation.
No. This was literally just me as a producer of an event in New York.
Describe the scene. You're in a club. It's called
not even in a club.
It's 2 a.m. You've taken all sorts of stuff.
None of that. It was like
rushing.
It was 8 p.m. We were in Times Square. On top of what, you know, on the rooftop bar in Times Square, financial event about to run the next day, you know, professional thing. I was just being courteous to say hello to people, you know, before I went to bed for the night. And
but the other people are dressed as a policeman and
no. It was
sailor.
Just a completely normal setting. You know, so my colleagues were over there, and you know, various bankers were here, there, and everywhere, and. Yeah, and then I was like, how the hell do I get out of this? You know?
You can't even knock his teeth out.
Well, I mean, like, well, what can I do? Like, well, okay, if I react badly, maybe you'll pull out tomorrow, and then, shit, I've lost my, you know, I've lost one of my big guys.
So many puns going by here that I'm just letting
so
go.
So it's just on. Like, so that that was another one. So I don't know how I turned that around then. He started, like, telling me his life story about, you know, being a closeted guy living in the South and how he got to New York and was so liberated. I was like, Jesus Christ, you know. So
the, in the end, you did what you had to do for the deal, right?
I did not in the end.
No, I just mean you made an agreement and shook on it. That's what I mean.
Nothing happened at all. But I mean, I didn't like chuck the drink in his face and walk. Because look, as blokes, you're not prepared. Like a girl would just chuck the drink in his face and walk off, right? Just like, what the fuck do you do in that scenario, you know? Anyway, less about my days as a senior conference producer, and let's get back to this. Oh, fucking hell. I tell you, there was another time running those central bank events, and we had like a journalist come, like it was a journalist attached to the publication. And we were in the Bank of England, and I can't remember the guy before Mark Carney was going to be talking for us. I forget his name now. Mm. And
William King, was it?
Yeah, he was giving like the keynote of this thing. And again, as the producer, you're kind of like, you don't run. You're kind of just there to shake hands, say hello, make sure everybody's all right, just kind of like do a bit of schmoozing and so on, and then kind of bugger off type thing. So I was there just doing my bit. The journalist who was sent came, clearly like hungover. His tie was like hanging down, and like he had like stuff, like stains all over his shirt. And he was like that, and I was like, "What the hell? Like, what are you doing? You can't go and meet Mervyn King, looking like, look at the fucking state on you. You look like Withnail. Look at the fucking state on you. What are you doing?" So that was another occasion where I had. That was an embarrassing situation to be in as well. So it was like, anyway, let's get back to Bitter Lake. It's brought up weird old memories. I remember that conference. The guys from Qatar were really sly as well. Really kind of not to be trusted. But anyway, let's carry on.
Dallas in the chat says you're getting the real deepest lore here.
Fucking hell.
Faisal became the new leader of Saudi Arabia. Faisal set out to modernize the country. He created Western-style bureaucracies and a welfare system. He even allowed television for the first time, but he faced two threats. One was from the religious leaders inside Saudi Arabia. They were the Wahhabists, who had brought his family to power and gave his rule legitimacy. They distrusted any idea of modernizing Saudi society. Faisal was also facing a dangerous...
Pause. Just to say, Adam Curtis kind of lets that land fairly innocuously. He says Faisal became the new leader. Well, it does seem like a lot of it was driven by obviously Britain and the US. Britain especially wanting Faisal to be a kind of counterweight to Nasser in Egypt. It seems that they kind of sort of feared that, you know, Nasser's Egypt could kind of rouse Arab nationalism in a way that would be, you know, certainly threatening to British interests. And it was better to have a kind of what they called a balance of power in the Arab Middle East rather than concentrating it all in Cairo. So there was a lot of British military assistance to assist Faisal into government when they had to pop off the previous King Saud, the one after the one who met Roosevelt, the one in between. He didn't just sort of rise naturally through the ranks through his own merit, so to speak.
Now, I don't want to lower the tone, but do you remember Dog Tanyan, the animated, like it was the four the musketeers, but they were dogs. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Is it just me, or does Cardinal Rishnu bear a striking resemblance to Faisal?
Yeah.
I just wanted to add to what Simon said as well. I think there was like a war, wasn't there? There was an internal war in Arabia. And like there was significant killing for the Saud family to come to sole power.
There was a coup, against the older King Saud. And Faisal sort of, you know, took over a lot of the running of government. But things started to heat up and Saud deployed troops against people.
Against naysayers.
Yes, so to speak. There was kind of quite a lot of the old, what they call the National Guard, which was like this sort of Praetorian sort of elite who would protect the regime. That was about 20,000 guys. They were being trained by the British and so on.
There's also just, I don't know if Curtis goes on to mention this, but in Saudi Arabia, obviously it's a country famous for its oil riches, but much of the oil of Saudi Arabia is in the eastern part of the country geographically and is under and around where the Shiite majority live. And obviously Saudis are strong Sunnis. The Saudi regime is strictly Sunni fundamentalist, but yeah, the Shiites are the majority of the population across large parts of the country, and also I think Bahrain and other places, Iraq as well, and much of Saudi's oil wealth is in the Shiite areas.
Just to get this right, Faisal's father was the original king, right? Well, it does look like him, doesn't it? Can you see what I'm talking about?
I
tell you who else has that physiognomy is Snoop Dogg, the rapper. Snoop Dogg, Cardinal Rishnu, and King Faisal have got
abroad.
Similar physiognomy. But just to get the lineage correctly, the original king who we saw last week, who was in the first part of that documentary, this documentary, he had a son.
Yeah.
That son was overthrown and Faisal was installed as the next sometime. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Got it.
From communism that was spreading through the Arab world. His solution was simple. Faisal decided to use the religious leaders and their conservative beliefs as a force to counter the international threat of communism. But he knew that this would also divert their attention away from his domestic policies. Faisal used the growing oil money to set up hundreds of schools and institutes across the Islamic world, some as far away as Pakistan. Their job was to spread Wahhabist ideas and help to turn Islam into a unified international force strong enough to stand up to communism. What Faisal was doing was taking the dangerous and unstable fanaticism at the heart of Saudi society and directing it outwards, beyond its borders.
Well, hold on a second. Can I just go back and have a look at those individuals in the Saudi crowd there? Was it me, or did they look of a different race?
Saudi Arabia. They were the Wahhabis,
what sort of
who had brought
it,
his family
they?
To power and gave his rule legitimacy.
Or
they distrusted any idea of modernising Saudi society. Faisal was also facing a dangerous situation abroad from communism that was spreading through the Arab world. His solution was simple. Faisal decided to use the religious leaders and their conservative beliefs as a force to counter the international threat of communism. But he knew that this would also divert their attention away from his domestic policies. Faisal used the growing oil money to set up hundreds of schools and institutes across the Islamic world, some as far away as Pakistan. Their job was to spread Wahhabist ideas and help to turn Islam into a unified international force strong enough to stand up to communism.
Horace, please.
Go on, Horace.
Yeah, well, like, I think what Curtis is saying here is true, but it doesn't explain that this is still happening today. Like, Wahhabism is still spread out of Saudi with loads of money right now. Like, it's taken over, for instance, Indonesia, which is a country of, I think, hundreds of millions of people, huge country, but a relatively modest, like, I've been to Indonesia, like, pretty calm form of Sunni Islam, except in the westernmost provinces, which is Sumatra Island. But yeah, it's a country with a lot of tolerance. You meet Muslims there, they're not, like, I mean, they go through the rites, but it's not an insane place where Sharia dominates every area of life. But thanks to Wahhabism, it is becoming one of those, and loads of other places, probably Malaysia as well. But like, and these are much further flung than Pakistan, right? And this is nothing to do with communism anymore. Communism was defeated in these countries in the 50s or 60s, right? Mm. Or decisively beaten. So it's not explaining. I mean, like, Curtis also likes to remind us of the silly things done in the pursuit of anti-communism, which is a fair point. I mean, a lot of dumb things go under that name. But why is Britain and America and so on supporting this today? Why are they allowing Wahhabism to be spread in London and Manchester, Bradford and so on right now? Mm-hmm. Doesn't address that.
Is it possible, because this has happened numerous times in the past as well, that they set up something or they helped to fund something that then got out of control and took on a life of its own?
Yeah.
I'm thinking in particular of the jihadis who were funded by Assad's father, and that got out of control. Like, he lost control of them. I'm thinking of the original Taliban, as another example.
My point was really that it's not out of control, and he's failing to explain that.
There is additional sort of context here. The Saudis were sort of mainlining money straight into Europe. They set up something called the Islamic Center of Geneva. There was a guy called Saeed Ramadan who took on that project in 1961. And that became the kind of organizational center for the Muslim Brotherhood. And so lots of the Muslim Brothers started moving into Europe, especially into Germany, and creating the networks of mosques and charities and Islamic organizations to sort of do
the Muslim Brotherhood is also fundamentalist Islam, isn't it? Salafism.
It's well known. It's not conspiratorial. That Ramadan was assisted by the CIA, tens of millions of dollars. The Swiss knew it. The German intelligence knew it.
What's the CIA's angle there then? Why are they doing that?
From my knowledge, I mean, obviously the Americans were heavily invested in NASA in Egypt, and I think there was probably anticipation of Soviet moves, towards the land bridge, towards Africa, when you started to have the kind of insurgencies that you saw in the sort of early 70s, places like Oman and so on, where there was a concern that the Soviets would be moving into the sort of resource-rich parts of Africa. And so they wanted to form defensive bulwarks at that stage from the sort of staging point of Egypt.
So we got there. They supported NASA as a non-communist, at least, or sometimes cooperated with the communists, but he was not a communist himself. And they're supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, his supposed nemesis,
yeah,
like the nemesis of him and Sadat and Mubarak and all that, and the current regime. Mm-hmm. So they're supporting both of those for anti-communist reasons, but yeah, again, continuing to do so now.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, well, if, I don't know whether they're still supporting the Muslim Brotherhood, because I mean,
yeah,
Muslim Brotherhood includes Hamas as well.
Yeah, and of course, Nasser took against the Muslim Brotherhood and sort of start cracking down on them in the mid '60s, and they, you know, rounded up a lot of people, and you know, Saeed Ramadan, you know, was condemned to death, you know, but he was in absentia, so to speak.
As and of we course, saw the other the Power of Nightmares,
and the, yeah, the other guy who was condemned was Saeed Qutb from the Power of Nightmares. So,
and yeah. Saeed Ramadan's son, I think, was or nephew was Tariq Ramadan, right?
Mm.
And Tariq Ramadan was the main Islamist scholar in like Oxford, I think he was based in, and then he was sort of relegated and maybe expelled from the country. I don't know, because of some sex scandal, like he was accused of molesting people or whatever. Mm. But Tariq Ramadan was a big figure, and said about 10 years ago. Mm. I was always hearing about him because I used to read kind of neocon media. I didn't really realize at the time, but Tariq Ramadan was mentioned all the time as, yeah, like, why is this man being paid to, you know, live in Oxford and preach proper fundamentalist stuff? And also it goes against Zionism. The Muslim Brotherhood genuinely is a real threat to Israel and Zionism. And as I said, Hamas is the Palestinian part of it.
One question I've got.
This continues into the, you know, 30 years into the post Cold War world. What the hell?
One question I've got is: is Islam a good bulwark against communism? And if so, how? What is it in? Because you're not allowed to do interest in Islam in theory. You know, there are respects in which you could make a kind of Islamic Marxism. There's a synthesis to be had there. So what is it in Islam that goes against communism?
Communism, most Marxism and communists is atheism, isn't it?
Simple atheism, yeah. We'll see that later on with Amin, who leads the communist revolution in Afghanistan in the early 70s. Or late 70s, I should say.
And communist regimes in practice, whether they really fervently believe in the atheism thing or not, they do generally suppress religious institutions, don't they? And independent imams or whatever, because they're independent, because they're a separate source of power, potentially.
But the idea here is that this is a, you know, I mean, you get to see in a short while, Faisal gives this speech in New York in 1966. And, you know, you can see he's quite a feisty and independent minded guy who's not just doing everything for the benefit of the US and exporting, you know, Wahhabism out of Saudi Arabia and into the West is great in order to allow the CIA to run his own internal security. But to displace the problems of those elements of his regime that might be in competition with him.
I mentioned last week that you know, potentially perhaps we should see the US Saudi relationship as an even more firm one than the US Israel one. That's saying a hell of a lot.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But it endures even more unquestionably. You know, isn't it remarkable that, I mean, that comes at the cost of, as we said, like spreading a form of Islam that our leaders proclaim to be against. They say that's too far, you know, it gives Islam a bad name and whatever, you know, because it's against gays and women or whatever reason they want to give. But it's not the kind of Islam that people like David Cameron would have said was good, right? Or that, you know, any of our leaders. And yet it is done. Well, I guess that just confirms what I said, that like this relationship is more important than any other, the US Saudi one, and also Britain, Saudi, and so on. Like, less discussed, you know. Everyone talks about Zionism now, but this one really does go under discussion.
Saeed Qutb, before they executed him, one of the things he famously said was, "America made Islam,"
meaning.
They effectively bolstered the growth and strength of aggressive Islamism.
Meaning like 20th century sort of Salaf is his kind of thing.
Yeah.
His own, right. Yeah. I read the book, I can't remember, it's one of the Mark Curtis books, like a real crazy lefty, but informative book. And he said the same thing. I mean, yeah, like Britain, it was all about Britain, but yeah, Britain has supported the Muslim Brotherhood all along, while also sometimes destroying elements of what they do and using them as a foil.
Yeah,
It's mad stuff.
Yeah.
Curious, isn't it? It's very strange.
I think it seems like intelligence services and nations operate with a level of, if you like, stable destabilization. You know, it's again, I go back as ever to the Vladislav Zhirkov thing of funding both sides to maneuver your interests into place. And if you have to destroy one of them, so be it.
And I suppose to always, it's a way of avoiding the what they see as the bigger threat of populism, right? Or something like populism.
Populism or religiously motivated, you know, militancy, you know, either of anything which but can't that. Be, yeah, either of which can't be bought off quite as easily.
What Faisal was doing was taking the dangerous and unstable fanaticism at the heart of Saudi society and directing it outwards, beyond its borders. It was a ruthless way of creating stability in his own country. America gave this tacit approval because it was part of the global struggle against communism. But in 1966, Faisal gave America a glimpse of how uncontrollable an ally Saudi Arabia could be. He went to New York and publicly attacked America's support for Israel. It caused an outrage.
The reasons are that, unfortunately, the Jews throughout the world support Israel. They provide assistance to Israel. And in our present situation, we consider those who provide assistance to our enemy as our own enemy. فنحن أعداء للاعتداء لأن إسرائيل اعتدت على العرب في وطنهم وأخرجتهم وشردتهم من بيوتهم وأراضيهم ورمتهم في المخيمات والملاجئ واحتلت بلاد.
Pause. Just to say, you can't understate the kind of shockwaves that that sort of sent through the DC Beltway establishment, and in New York when he gave that speech, where you know he pointed the jacuzzi at Israel. Mayor Lindsay, who was a Republican, was going to have a dinner reception for him, and he just cancelled it immediately. He came out. Stating that, you know, the cancellation was because of what the king said. And he said, because the king said, those who are friends of Israel are enemies of my country. And Mayor Lindsay said, you know, they'd give him police protection and they would give him all the courtesies, but they didn't want to draw attention to the point he made. And there were various people in the House of Representatives. There was a guy called Seymour Halpern. He called the King's remarks a deplorable breach of United States hospitality. He said that American Jews were barred by the King from visiting Saudi Arabia, and added that King Faisal should know that he will be unwelcome in New York City because New York City takes pride in respecting the race, color, and religious faith of all its citizens. Leonard Farbstein, who was a New York Democrat, he told the House that he'd sent a telegram to Mayor Lindsay requiring cancellation of the Faisal dinner. He was quoted as saying, Jewish taxpayers' funds should not be used for a feast for their declared enemy.
What year was that? Sorry.
1966. June, it was 23rd of June 66 he made that speech. If you look for that speech, this is very interesting. I was kind of looking for the speech and for footage. Curtis has got a bit there. I challenge you to find it. I couldn't find it at all. When you look it up, you do like do an AI search or something. It says the exact wording of the speeches is not readily available. There are excerpts from the American Presidency Project which indicate that King Faisal spoke about peace, justice, prosperity, and cooperation. But all the footage is untranslated, so there's no subtitles. I found one part of the speech, but that was just like a Q&A section that Faisal did at the end. So there was four parts of the speech on this particular website. Three of them were unavailable. You couldn't find them. And the fourth part, which was kind of a nothing burger bit, was available. So it does tend to look like it was kind of... downplayed somewhat online. I'm not necessarily saying it's all white, but my foundations of research couldn't come up with it.
Curious.
I was just going to say that, you know, I've been doing my little experiments with Grok where I do these Socratic dialogues or I, you know, challenge it back and forth and so on. On one occasion, I was getting it to do a comparison of the various achievements of the peoples of the world, right? I was saying, like, compare, like, the achievements of the Chinese with white Europeans, with, you know, various Arabs, Persians, Africans, and so on and so forth. And obviously the Jews were one of the groups that they talked about. And as one of the achievements of the Jewish people, Grok put forward New York City as evidence. And I said, Grok, the idea that New York is a Jewish achievement is an anti-Semitic canard. And then it started like backpedaling and defending itself, saying, oh, well, I didn't mean to say that. It's totally down to, you know, but like, I just found it really interesting that that was its answer, you know. So
it's funny that, where those remarks I quoted, which, you know, were you know, excoriating Faisal, were from JTA.org, the Jewish Telegraph Agency. So
curious.
Someone's confused.
I mean, I can see why they consider that particularly, because I noticed he used the word Yehud, which means Jews, right? Not specifically Zionists. And his critique there was not just of Israel, it was of Jews around the world for supporting Israel.
It's not just the Jewish, it's the Jewish hood in New York. Yehud.
Oh.
As opposed to Dahud. As opposed to Dahud. Brooklyn, as opposed to Bronx. Dahud and Yehud. Anyway, carry on.
I will say Faisal did try to pour oil on this. In 1967, he wrote to LBJ. I'll just read it, what he wrote to him. It's only very short. And excuse the fact, his grammar and his syntax aren't quite correct. So it suggests he's maybe written it himself or maybe. It says, permit me to say, Mr. President, that the decisions at the Arab Summit conference were highly constructive. The door has been opened for the Western camp to reconsider its hardened position so as to enable its friends amongst Arabs to persuade hot-headed Arab peoples that the West and those who travel in its orbit are not standing against them in their dispute with Israel, and in order to give leaders of Arab countries the opportunity to proceed to further constructive steps towards producing a just solution to the problem. So a little bit of a Trumpian tactic on the part of Faisal there. Turn up the heat and then, you know, pour the soothing balm on to LBJ to get him to.
Like, I was going to point out as well, this was 1 year before the Six-Day War, right? Which is generally considered a pivotal point in sort of Zionist Arab relations, isn't it? And just for those who aren't aware, like Saudi, most of the time since its origination, I guess, has been treated as like the so-called leader of the Arab world or the Muslim world, right? I mean, not everyone acknowledges that, but if there is a leader, it's probably Saudi because they're big and powerful and rich and whatever. Sometimes it has been, I think, Nasser, like Egypt, like Nasser's Egypt was sometimes like vying for that leadership. But whoever it is, anyway, is generally held by the rest of the Muslim world, at least the Arab world, because of Palestinians being Arabs, as like responsible for sticking up for the Arabs, you know, the Palestinians, at least verbally, right? And not that they don't sincerely believe it as well, but that's something that, like, any, you know, most Saudi kings are sort of speaking. It's become more complicated in the last 10 or 20 years, I'm sure, because of the Abraham Accords, but which is sort of an agreement to screw over the Palestinians, really. So it sounds like Faisal here was like pretty heartfelt about it, actually really believed that he was doing that, you know.
There's also a historical reason that the Saudis should be considered the leaders of the Arabs, which Glubb talks about in his short history of the Arab peoples, which starts with a kind of autistic breakdown of all of the different Arab groups, where he says, like, look, Palestinians, Lebanese, Egyptians, like, they've been admixed with other groups. Whereas the Saudis, are the pure Arabians. They're the originals. So we're like in Arab hierarchy, they are like the top of the tree, according to Glubb. Whereas the others, like Syrians, even are not the purest Arabs, according to Glubb. I don't know how true that is, but that was his perception as the leader of the Transjordanian army for however long he was. he got to know them pretty well. And yeah, so there we go.
Okay.
For 3 months.
I see money in my
account.
That's okay.
Possibly for 6 months. Yes, yeah. If you like it for all times,
for
1 year,
for what I need from you is
how many months?
Conditions and how much it'll be.
Tell me, tell me permission. My,
my. That's it for the people.
Yeah.
It's up to your work.
No, my actually Rome very.
Ho. Do you have a lot of all that tuner and developer?
Yeah, we want you to maintain it and service it. Okay.
اینا که هست فوتوکاپی ماشینش میخوان همراه کاغذاش از پشتون میخرن دیگه از پشتون رنگش میخره هر چیزش
نه صرف کرای ماشین
کرای ماشینه و دیگه چیزا رو که میدین باز
میبرید
سر وی ویل بای پیپر فرام دیم دی کلر فرام دیم دی اذرز ار فور رنت اتس اوکی
Yeah, can you give me the price for 3 months, possibly for 6 months?
Yes.
The contract must last for 3 months.
Okay.
But the same one can order.
Yak mo mo $500 version can order.
$500 per month.
Per month.
It's very expensive.
You can
if you have if you bringing in here, you can set in here. I will copy for you.
No, we want to take the copier away.
More Bowie. He must have had a deal. He must have had a deal with Bowie for this one.
Really, it's hard to get release on.
Well,
Bowie,
I mean, right? I just imagine Bowie is expensive, and I'm just saying this is the second Bowie song in one documentary.
Obviously, Beauty Brothers is a great track, but it's going to be cut slightly oddly again because I mentioned last week there was an ITV claim on excerpts of Carry On Up the Khyber, which Curtis mixed in with bits here of these Taliban guys and. Yeah, this amusing sequence with the parachute regiment trying to hire a photocopier.
And so the story goes, they wore the clothes, they said the things to make it seem improbable. The will of a lie like the hope it was. And the good men tomorrow had their feet in the wallow and their heads of brawn were nice ashore and how they bought their positions with saccharine and trust. And the world was asleep to our meat and fuss. Sang the swell through the streets like the crust of the sun, the beauty brought.
Do you ever feel frustrated that perhaps, I mean, you've spoken about corruption and certainly in the past you've made very strong moves against officials, for example, who are corrupt, but many of those officials haven't left their jobs, they haven't obeyed your orders?
No, they have all left their jobs. Certainly.
In the past few days, of the 28 that you have sacked, 19, our information is that 19 of them are still in their positions.
No, that's not true. They've all gone. They've all gone.
Okay.
Definitely. Definitely.
So you're confident then that your power is building in terms of being able to enact, to make sure that your orders are obeyed?
I'm building a new administration for Afghanistan. I'm working on a clean, efficient administration.
Back! Battle! Back the fuck up! Get the fuck out of the way! Get the fuck out!
Pause. Just a little bit of context on that. That was an interview from about March 2005 there. Karzai was being quizzed about, there was about, I think, something like 28 officials who were being sacked, regional officials in intelligence, police, customs, you know, agriculture departments who were essentially engaged in corruption, which, you know, this is an accusation that dogged him throughout his term in as the president of Afghanistan up to 2014. And there was all sorts of things like embezzlement of money, you know, people being beaten up, robberies, just ignoring government directives and just generally being unqualified for what they were supposed to do. And Karzai The always interesting thing about Karzai, I notice, is he's always got this interesting costume on. That particular cape he wears is called a chapan, and it's an Uzbek cape, a green silk cape. And he also wears a little funny grey hat, you see him in the footage, and that's a Tajik cape. And then when he goes to move among Pashtuns, he'll wear a turban. So in a way, he kind of adopts the sort of, you know, the Donald Trump, you know, wearing the purple tie after the day of the election kind of motif. You know, you unite both sides in your, you know, symbolic dressing for power. So just interesting little notes about him.
Am I right in remembering that he, this before they had any sort of elections or anything, any sort of new process, that like he was appointed basically by the occupiers?
More or less, yeah. He was kind of shuffled into position to be an interim, regime.
Yeah, and that was never much explained, really, about why this guy, you know, the new guy who's emerged, it's yeah. Hamid Karzai.
Stone, he was wax, so he could scream and still relax. Unbelievable. And he frightened the small children away. And our talk was old, and dust would flow through our veins, and though it was midnight back in the kitchen door, like the grim face on the cathedral floor. The solid book we wrote cannot be found today. And it was stalking time for the Moon Boys, the Beaulieu Brothers. With our backs on the arch, and if the devil may be here, then he can't sing about that.
Pause.
The other day, a friend of Blue P.
Just a little bit of interest on that clip there for the military buffs. I don't know if you could hear that little sort of ringing that was on the soundtrack there. Accompanying that clip of the soldiers, the guy with the big backpack that was walking along, that wasn't a radio. That's he's what's called the ECM guy. That's the electronic countermeasures guy. That backpack is basically a signal jammer, because obviously one of the big things about Afghanistan and Iraq was the introduction of things like improvised explosive devices, and the ECM is the thing that you use to jam the remote signals that set them off. Because the way they're patrolling there in the military, they would call it bus route patrolling, you know, regular kind of routes. And that ringing sound on the soundtrack is the interference from the ECM that's being recorded as he's wandering along there.
Angela Mulliner invited me to help her groom some dogs with very shaggy coats indeed, a pair of Afghan hounds.
Stay you, don't they?
They do. This should be a good spot.
You need plenty of space to groom dogs this size, so we picked the park. Their names were Kingsley and Cleo, and I said I'd do Cleo.
How often is one supposed to do this?
Very frequently.
Oh, gosh. Don't sit down, Cleo. There's a good girl.
Angela and I wanted the dogs to look their very best because we were taking them out on a special assignment. We were all going off to the Mall, and we had to be there by 12 o'clock.
Come on then, dogs.
We felt very proud of Kingsley and Cleo because they'd been invited to join a guard of honour. Afghan hounds were going to salute their king because for the first time ever, the king of Afghanistan was coming to London. About 20 members of the Southern Afghan Hound Society had brought their dogs along to line the route, and there were Afghans of all colours and sizes. And when the Queen pointed us out, the King of Afghanistan seemed delighted to see us. For the first time in their lives, British Afghan hounds were seeing people from their own country, because in the carriages that followed the Queen, there were more people from the Royal Court of Afghanistan.
But the ordered world, where kings and queens ruled and dogs behaved obediently, was about to collapse. In 1971, the King of Afghanistan had come on his first ever state visit to Britain. But it was also his last, because his ambitious Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud, was already plotting against him. And in 1973, Daoud took power in a coup. He declared Afghanistan a republic and sent the king into exile.
Pause. Just a little clip from the Adam Curtis blog, actually. He mentions how Afghan hounds at that time became the most popular dogs in Britain. And there was actually a new sport introduced of Afghan hound racing, which they used to do at the Wolverhampton dog track. But as he says, the Afghan hounds had a terrible tendency not to do what they were told and instead would start attacking each other.
Sorry, is that to suggest that Afghan hounds are actually genetically Afghan?
No comment.
I imagine they were bred by the English when the English were in Afghanistan.
He's underlining a point, yeah.
Two months later, Egypt attacked Israel, and a Middle East war started. To begin with, it looked as though Israel would be defeated. But the American government came to its rescue, failed to prevent the Israelis from being overwhelmed. The Israelis counterattacked, and the Arabs faced a disaster. But then Saudi Arabia came to the rescue, because King Faisal realized that his country had a weapon that could stop Israel. Overnight, Faisal raised the price of oil 5 times and threatened a complete embargo unless America forced Israel to...
Classic bit of Curtis before the big event footage here. This is obviously like not meant to be seen or filmed, right? This bit, Simon.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, like you were saying, like you were saying
that pre to the interview, you mean. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This is clearly him going over his notes and rehearsing and so on.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's an interesting moment here where they start whacking up the oil price. Faisal literally says, quote, to the USA, "You are the ones who can't live without oil. Our ancestors lived on dates and milk, and we can easily go back to living like that again."
And they've been playing this trick over and over again since, really, isn't it? Since the 70s. They've done it like 5-6 times in history.
Yeah, they were earning about $8 to $9 billion a year up to 73, and by a year later their revenues were up to $34 billion.
Oh, we're talking about the Six-Day War here, I think, aren't we? 6 years earlier than the 73 one. But we saw the 73 war. I mean, I expect they did the same here as well, because, you know, at least threatening like an increase in the prices. But we saw the 73 oil country reaction in the Mayfair set, didn't we? With that guy.
Imani, who's coming up.
Yeah, basically laughing about it.
Pull back. It worked. A ceasefire was agreed. And everyone realized that the balance of power in the world had suddenly changed.
Pause. Sorry, I think I miscorrected you there. That was about the 73.
This is 73, yeah, but you're right. Sorry. About 67.
We skipped forward.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah, a few minutes ago we were on 66, weren't we? So.
What we want is the complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces from the occupied Arab territories. And then you'll have the oil at the same level of September 73.
Is this demand absolute and rigid, or is this just a negotiating position?
Definitely. We won't give up any inch of these lands.
Doesn't this new massive increase in the price of oil mean a change in the world balance of power between the developing nations like you, the producers, and us, the developed industrialized nations?
Yes, it will.
And what do you think arises from that?
Well, a new type of relationship. You have to adjust yourself to the new circumstances. And I think you have to sit down and talk seriously with us about this new era.
When Saudi Arabia raised the price of oil, they did it to change the political balance of power in the world. But it also had another unexpected effect, because it allowed the men who ran the banks and the financial system in America and Britain to begin to break free of political control. Billions of dollars flooded from the West into Saudi Arabia, most of which the Saudis didn't know what to do with. So they gave them to the Western banks to invest. The banks then made a crucial decision. They kept many of those dollars free from control by the American government, and they became a vast pool of wealth.
That's really interesting connection that Curtis is drawing here. Very interesting.
He doesn't mention why loads of Western money flowed into the Arab countries at this time. Does anyone know? What's that referring to? Why?
Well, for the oil.
For the oil money. And he's explaining the creation of the petrodollar.
He's talking about money that was spent on buying the oil.
The money that was made by the Arabs on buying the oil, they didn't know what to do with. So then they stuck them in Western banks. Mm-hmm. But that Arab money that was stuck in Western banks allowed the banks to break free of government oversight and control.
I don't know what he means by that either. That's his old thing. He talks about that in hypernormalization as well, doesn't he? Like there's apparently a moment in the 70s. You know, we'll come to that in the later documentary. But he also mentioned 10 or 20 seconds ago. He said there was loads of more Western investment. I think that's what he said. That it was, you know, this was a time when loads more Western investment came into the oil producing countries as well. I'm not really sure why. Anyway.
Known as petrodollars, that could be lent and traded anywhere around the world without political control. As Western politicians struggled to deal with the economic...
I don't know if this is something we can resolve here, but I've never quite understood this petrodollar thing. Like, why were these dollars floating free? Why were they sort of implying that they're in neither one country or the other or something? There's this sort of market, like...
Well, the petrodollar is something. I mean, I didn't really understand a petrodollar, so I sort of had to look up definitions. I mean, it seems to be that there's three different versions of what the petrodollar means. One is dollars paid to oil-producing nations, quote petrodollar recycling. It was a term invented in the 70s, meaning the trading surpluses of oil-producing nations, or it could be currencies of oil-producing nations which tend to rise in value against other currencies when the price of oil rises, or it's just the pricing of oil in US dollars, currencies used as a unit of account to price oil in the international market. So essentially, it's also tied into the fact that there was a sort of trade of direct exchange. I mean, you had back in the 60s there, they talked about there was $100 million dollar arms contract, which we sealed with the Saudis. And later you had the Al Yamama deal in the 80s, which, generated something like 40, 50 billion pounds. Where the Saudis essentially, BAE, the big arms manufacturer, would supply them with things like, you know, Tornado jets and military hardware in exchange for something like 600,000 barrels of oil a year. And that would come in through the MOD, be given to like Shell and BP, who would then sell the oil and then pay off BAE systems with profits from those oil sales.
So that's another unusual thing about the oil industry, is that you have an assignment or an allotment of 600,000 barrels per day or whatever it is, or per week or whatever it is, per month.
It goes down over time, but yeah, that was a sort of baseline.
Like, not in every industry do the producers before or ahead of production agree that, yeah, some portion of it goes to this country, to that country. That's specifically a thing in oil, and it's because of the strategic importance in the eyes of the producer, the buyers, basically. Like, they want to know in advance, we're definitely getting that oil. We're not bidding for it as it's produced.
And in the British case, it allows the government to prop up British arms creation through the big, through BAE.
Right.
So we don't have to subsidize them too much.
And a degree of price predictability, because otherwise you'd be relying on constantly fluctuating commodity prices. So there's like contracts agreed ahead. But yeah, what you said about the petrodollar, there's the three meanings that you mentioned. The second one is kind of redundant, I think, like remarking on the value of the oil producing countries' currencies. That's not generally how it's used. But the other two meanings, it's a mixture of those normally. is typically used by critics, right? You don't hear many people, like proponents of this relationship, talking about the petrodollar. They don't like to draw attention to it, right? But it's a mixture of, yeah, the phenomenon that oil is generally sold in dollars, even when America's not involved. That is a thing. I don't really understand that or why that is. And also the fact that, what was the first meaning that you said again for it?
The dollars paid to oil producing nations, right. Meaning so the trading services trade. Of oil producing nations.
Okay, so it's mostly the third meaning there. But it's like ever since the second Iraq war, anyway, I've heard people would say, like, you know, conspiracy theory types, but they're not necessarily idiots, like would say that the motive for that war, for the killing of Gaddafi and certain other interventions, maybe Assad as well and stuff, it's because these countries supposedly, I don't know if this is true, but supposedly threatened or began to start trading oil, selling oil, without any involvement of the dollar, like no dollar denomination or anything, just directly selling it in euros or Arab dirhams or, what, you know, whatever, dinars and stuff, but anything but the dollar, like that began to break the petrodollar system. That was seen as a threat by America, which is just, you know, obsessed with oil, according to leftists. Not that they're completely wrong about that, but yeah. Anyway, like, so basically what we've got here is a term that's not that clearly understood. And unfortunately, Curtis doesn't tend to bring clarity in these areas either.
Economic and social chaos that had been created by the oil price rise, their bankers were building a new global financial system based on recycling the Saudi billions. And the banks began to become rich and powerful again.
Pause, please. Sorry, I know I sound like I'm nitpicking, but what do you mean by recycling? What do you mean recycling money? What does that mean? Like getting it and putting it in an account? What he never specifies.
One of the answers that I've collated here is because the petrodollar is denominated in US dollars, the system means that oil producing countries end up with surpluses of US currency that need to be, quote, recycled back into the economy. Petrodollar recycling can involve channeling these dollars back into their own domestic economies, lending them to other countries or investing them in the US economy. Countries can use them to buy assets and securities like treasury bills, helping to keep interest rates and inflation low and allowing the countries to avoid currency conversion losses and risks.
Okay, so we're talking about the complex operations of states in regard to like foreign currency reserves, of which they had a huge amount of dollars, right? Yeah. You'd think like just spending it on American products would be one way to deal with that surplus, wouldn't you? Yeah. But the other thing, like Curtis just says there, and so the banks began to become rich and powerful again. That's another bizarre Curtisism, right? In the mid-70s, what you say, saying before then, for some decades, whatever, banks weren't rich and powerful. Like, what such weird mystical nonsense from Curtis.
Well, there is this moment where New York is declared bankrupt in 1975.
And he shows it in Hypernormalization. Yeah, he makes
which is typically seen as the moment that the banks take over.
Like Curtis, though.
Then you
get people who talk about neoliberalism.
Yeah, but then you get Thatcher and Reagan.
Yeah,
and you get a decisive weakening of the state. You get a decisive weakening of the state and state controls against the finance sector. That's when it becomes unmoored, according to Curtis. So,
and you get the massive surge of American banks into London.
I think that supposedly followed Big Bang, which was actually some years later. That was like 83 or 84.
I actually remember Keith Woods had a video about this at one point as well. I don't know exactly when it was, but about that whole, the transition of the banks becoming powerful in the 70s. And before then, there was a lot of checks on them. But it was undone mainly by Reagan.
Yeah, I think this is really like a leftist canard. There's not that much. When they talk about the start of neoliberalism in the mid-70s, there is some meaning to that because that was... But this was under Labour, I would emphasise, in Britain. This was 4 years.
Forget, the IMF came in.
Yeah, because the post-war consensus led to that, basically. Led to, like, we literally can't even stay afloat.
But it transferred from an industrial-based economy to a financialised economy. It's the essential pivot, yeah?
sort of, but industry went on and finance didn't completely take over. I'm not, I think way too much emphasis. I disagreed with Keith Woods when he put that video. I remember that video as well. Yeah, like I was like, why have you seen, this is the weakest bit of what Curtis is saying. This is the weakest bit of the documentary. It's not that significant. Like what's showed in hyper normalization is like New York wasn't, the banks had been lending a certain steady, immense, probably growing as well, but steady, immense amount of money to New York City. And then at some point they started demanding stricter terms and like a firmer promise of repayment or whatever. Like that's not that significant. What that is just a city having gone too far. And this is the moment when they realize they've gone too far, you know, a state, a city, you know, state administration. Same happened with countries around the same time. What that was the post-war consensus failing, but Curtis never, obviously, doesn't want to admit that because he loves the post-war consensus and hates everything that came after.
Okay.
Taliban
Taliban po marja kidi marja
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 Taliban se na marja marja marja
Assalamu alaikum.
Are we in Kushal Calais now? Is this Kushal Calais? What is the name of this village?
This
is the edge of Kushal Calais. Yeah. Have the Taliban gone now, or they're still in Kushal Calais?
Taliban is in the village.
Okay. Where have you seen Taliban? Where?
Right, sir.
This guy's IDing these here and saying the Taliban.
Yeah, who is the room there?
Yeah, two men.
Taliban,
yeah?
Pause, please. Just want to check the music. Do you know what this is, Simon?
I'm trying to see if it's in my notes. I think it's one of those ones I couldn't quite pick up. It could be something from Drive, I think, by Cliff Martinez, but I'm not sure. I don't think it was. Yeah.
Don't Did we know. Have a bit of Aphex Twin a minute ago as well? Do we sometimes get Aphex Twin in the mix?
Not particularly in this one. The relies on there's a lot of this Cliff Martinez guy, the soundtrack to Drive, obviously the bits of Burial, a lot of Nine Inch Nails in this episode as well. And there was an artist called Wendy who did a big sort of grumbly droney piece early on. He's got a lot more of these kind of very spacious atmospheric type bits of music, but some of them are a bit hard to identify and they're quite obscure.
Someone in the chats that said what an unusual surprise or unexpected the Nine Inch Nails were used. I would say the idea of Adam Curtis using Nine Inch Nails possibly one of the most expected things of all time.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah.
When I first watched this, I was a little bit surprised. I was like, oh, he's got quite a good range, you know.
He's a bit from, yeah.
Sorry, I don't know if anyone watching has ever played the Fallout computer games, but Fallout 1, the opening music sounds remarkably like this bit. Really ominous sounding, really bleak and dry and dusty as well. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, he uses a bit from Corona Radiata by Nine Inch Nails in a sequence that's just coming up, I think, if it's not the tailing end of this bit.
Did you say Corona Radiata?
Corona Radiata is one of their tracks. He uses it quite a few times.
That sounds like something out of a post-nuclear world as well.
it's a sort of it's the kind of nerve stem that joins the top bit of your brain to your spinal cord.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like the glow around a person who's irradiated. You know, like corona of
crown, light. Radiant crown. Yeah.
As Western countries collapsed economically in the 1970s, students from Europe and America fled from the chaos. They came to Afghanistan as a land of dreams, a different, innocent world, free of the corruption of politics and money in the West.
Then you see some Afghan come dozing out of the sand, hardly give you a look, and carry on past. You long to ask, where are you going? Where have you come from? But he just disappears into the murk, going about his everyday business. A traveller is someone who proceeds through a country under his own initiative, with a certain internal drive to learn, to find out something more than the superficial. To me, an Afghan was some figure from a woodblock print in a book about India. The reality of an Afghan was so beyond that, their strength of character, which comes through in their most simple action.
This is a long jacket for men. A fur for generation, which That's goes it. From mother to daughter. A possum, shallow coat. This is antelope. This is mulan, a mulan coat.
That's it.
Are these the famous Buddha statues that were defaced?
Yeah, blown up in 2001.
But Afghan students still believed in the idea of revolution. Back in the 1960s, many students from Kabul University had been sent to universities in America. It had been part of the modernization project. And they brought back with them radical ideas from the American student left. Back in Kabul, those ideas then got mixed up with other left-wing theories that the Afghan students found in badly translated Russian books about Marxism. And in 1978, they decided to have a revolution. One of the leaders was Hafizullah Amin. And after the revolution, he ordered a film to be made about the role he had played. Amin also starred in the film, playing himself. It shows policemen coming to Amin's house to arrest him. He tries to hide some secret papers. But the policemen take him to jail, leaving his wife and daughter. Amin is then shown directing the revolution from his prison cell.
Poor act there, I can tell. Even through Curtis's music. I know he's playing himself, but it's not good acting, Simon. Would you agree?
It's terrible. You've got to hand it to the left. They're always on top of the culture game in terms of dramatizing the events. In fact, even the Soviets didn't like this guy. He was a communist. It was this what's called the Tsar Revolution in April 1978. And he only ruled for about 3 months before the Russians bumped him off, because they said he was a power-hungry man who was distinguished by his brutality and his treachery, and characterized him as a man of insincerity and duplicity. So, he wasn't quite the full sort of avuncular Father Christmassy type figure giving out money to his wife that was shown there.
And then riding on a tank to the president's palace.
Tanks loyal to young communist army officers now guard the palace where President Daud ruled. Inside, he and his family, including his young grandchildren, were shot dead when his palace guard lost their courageous battle to defend him. Men from the different tribes who live in this backward country swarm all over tanks knocked out in the battle. They seem pleased to see the end of the old feudal regime.
The revolutionaries gave a press conference. Amin, it was announced, would become foreign minister. And the president of the Revolutionary Council was another ex-student, Mohammad Taraki.
Our relationship with all the countries, including Soviet Union, and all our neighbors and throughout the world, will be based and depend on the amount of their support to our revolutionary government in political, economical field.
Does this mean, Mr. President, that you will be following the strict policy of non-alignment?
This is quite correct.
The aim of the revolution was to create a new Afghanistan, and parades were held in Kabul to celebrate the radical vision. One of the main aims was to redistribute land fairly, to get rid of a feudal system of landowners and peasants. Every farmer was to be allowed to own their own land, and young revolutionaries from Kabul were filmed going out into the countryside to measure out the new plots, followed by the grateful farmers kissing their new land certificates. But in reality, the land reforms set the seeds for a bitter conflict in Helmand. It made the divisions that had begun with President Daud's reforms in the 1960s much worse. As the land was parcelled out, families accused each other of stealing the best bits, and all sorts of hatreds and rivalries were born in Afghan rural society. Rivalries that would set village against village, tribe against tribe. And in Kabul, the revolutionaries started to hate each other too. Hafizullah Amin decided that he should be in charge, and he arranged for his rival Taraki to be killed. Taraki was smothered with a cushion. Amin ordered that anyone who opposed the reforms should be thrown in jail or killed. In Helmand, 100 political prisoners were taken up in a plane and thrown into the giant lake created by the American dam. The Soviet leaders in Moscow became terrified that Afghanistan was falling apart, and they decided to intervene. They rang Amin to tell him that they were sending Russian troops to help his revolution. And at the end of 1979, the troops began to arrive at Kabul airport. What the Russians didn't tell Amin was that the troops were also coming to kill him. The Russians put a sniper on one of the main roads in Kabul, but Amin's convoy drove too fast and the sniper missed.
Yes, I don't know.
They tried again. This time they put poison in Amin's can of Pepsi in the presidential palace. But his nephew drank it instead. And died.
Another rasputin case on our hands.
Always stick with the original Coke.
Amin gave a banquet in a palace outside Kabul. The Soviets smuggled in a chef who poisoned the food. This time it worked. All the guests and Amin fell on the floor, writhing in agony. But the Afghan servants rang for help, and two Russian doctors turned up who knew nothing of the plot. They pumped Amin's stomach and he revived. So the Russian...
Yeah. Sorry for laughing, it's comical, isn't it?
Troops attacked the palace, threw a grenade at Amin and shot him.
Oh, so he did get shot in the end.
Yeah, he was being treated for the poisoning and he was kind of wandering around the palace in just his shorts. He had tubes in him and saline drips and things, and the Russians sort of came in and, you know, he thought they were there to help him. And as Curtis says, they just they saw him, threw a grenade at him and then finished him off with shooting him.
Just like Curtis, don't think he really goes on to explain, but like this, it's pretty mad for the Soviets to do this, right? Like, what exactly was their motivation? He was not a Soviet stooge, but he was quite friendly to them.
He was felt to be more sympathetic to the Americans, as it happened.
Oh right.
The difference between him and Taraki, the old mustachioed guy who we saw at the beginning. Taraki, would blame the Americans and the Iranians and the Pakistanis for the situation going on in Afghanistan, and Amin would play down the involvement of the US, or China,
From what I've seen, this was sort of started somewhat haphazardly by the Soviets, because obviously there had been this monarchy which was not friendly to communism until earlier in the 70s or something. Hmm. Like the Afghan had been a kingdom, hadn't it? Hmm. So why they decided that they were going to sort of seize this opportunity at this point, from what little I know of it, Soviet politics was somewhat not centralized enough in a way. Like Brezhnev was aging, but he was still the boss for another 3 years after this, I think. And people on the Politburo were running their own fiefs. And when it came to, I don't know, they called it the military-industrial complex, they began to act on their own, and they wanted this war because they produced a lot of armaments and stuff, and they were up for it, spoiling for a fight. But it didn't really make political sense. It just, obviously, we know that it went on to become their disaster, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was the essential driver that, it was actually Andropov who suggested Amin was going in a pro-US direction.
Right, Andropov did that on other occasions. Like I said, we've got to take out this guy. I think he instigated the the takeover of Czechoslovakia in 68 as well.
Thank you.
Some great sequences in this film.
It is, and this is a brilliant thing which you can sort of just overlook as a kind of textural sequence. But I think this is one of the very specific stylistic examples that Curtis addresses comments that he's been making around the time that he's putting this documentary together. And I've referred to it before, but he was doing around this time, he did a sort of stage event with Russell Brand and John Ronson, the guy who does that book, The Men Who Stare at Goats. And he's kind of interested. He's a bit like a kind of low rent Louis Theroux. He's interested in sort of conspiracy theory type stuff, but the more kind of amusing end of it. And at this point, this was where I think you've seen the contrast between the story of what happens with Amin's kind of failed communist revolution and this kind of quite violent footage, which is really interesting because it's the way it's done is it's actually BBC. It's camera footage of this riot going on, but it's filmed on a television. So it's kind of, I think it's Curtis is sort of giving a bit of a nudge that it's already kind of two resolutions away from being real. And it's this idea of popular uprising. And I think he's kind of making a metaphorical rebuke at this time. He's shown the sort of reality of the communist revolution ends badly. The Soviets come in and wipe people out. And he uses this kind of more immediate moment of popular uprising. And it ties into this thing he was saying on this particular stage event that I've quoted before. Where Curtis was getting upset with the kind of, you know, the extreme left who were asking for sort of popular uprising. And he says in the account of this time, when he's talking with Russell about the time he had on stage with Russell Brand, he says, I mean, I ended up saying to the audience, well, you know, you say you want change and revolution. Do you know what revolution really involves? It's really like everything goes and you lose your savings and nothing's stable. What revolution is really involved? It's really like everything goes and you lose your savings, nothing's stable, blah, 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 blah. And what do you really want? Do you just want the banks to be a little bit nicer? You know? And he said, and then there was a complete silence from the audience and it was very funny. And then Russell Brand sort of stepped in and tried to kiss him. But this is a thing that Curtis has about this sort of unrealistic political aspiration of the left. And this was around the same time Russell Brand was sort of going on Newsnight and saying, you know, what's the point of voting? And all of this stuff. And for Curtis, it doesn't kind of ultimately completely resolve, but he says when you push forward a little bit, you know, just after this point, you get to Brexit. There's a point to voting in so much as he describes the British people being given this giant button that says fuck off to the elites and they press it. And that's where he feels we've kind of landed at. So it's this, you know, decision point between do you want to really upend the system completely or do you just want to make these adjustments? And the contrast you have with the end of this footage is where, you know, the reality that's observable there is, you know, it's the Americans using their target acquisition system from a drone. And you're basically seeing most of the time nothing is happening. You know, that's perhaps I think his way of addressing that and saying, look, you know, most of the time politically things are pretty uneventful. There's nothing to kind of really get that angry about. You maybe just want to make some course corrections and adjustments here and there. I think that's Curtis's position, and he describes it visually.
One of the questions I have about Curtis is that, given all of the stuff that he's pointed out himself, given all the stuff that he's said in these things, rather than lamenting the end of the old post-war consensus, etc., which is clearly where his sympathies lie, why doesn't Curtis also want to say fuck off to the elites? Because clearly those elites that he venerates were replaced by neoliberals. I don't understand.
I think he does. And I think sometimes Horace is overstating how much Curtis is a kind of just out and out leftist. I think, you know, I read a lot of interviews and accounts he gives actually, and he is in favor of people, you know, he's very scathing about I posted a quote from a recent interview last night that he's very scathing about the left, which tells the people who voted Brexit that they're idiots and they're worthless. And he keeps trying to tell the left, this is what got Trump in. If you're so concerned about Trump, it's your arrogant dismissal of people in this particular manner that rankles and it reeks of a kind of, you know, a strange liberal elitism which they've taken upon themselves. So I don't think it's a question of him being completely sort of, you know, with the comrades and wanting revolution. I mean, Curtis himself talks about his politics and says, you know, most of the time you can't tell what my politics is from my films because I adopt different positions. You know, he'll say that, for instance, in Century of the Self, he talks about the, you know, the problematic nature of hyper individualism as it sort of washes out into politics and commerce. And then, you know, he'll take a more kind of progressive standpoint in something like Can't Get You Out of My Head, where he's premising a lot of the story on, you know, the activation of a political, you know, tumult in the 20th century on the sort of colonial and racist history of European countries. So he'll argue from the progressive side there as well. And he will say, I don't actually know what my politics is most of the time, because as a journalist, you go into issues and your political position will change once you start sort of uncovering some of the kind of grimy, gruesome facts about what is happening in a situation. So I don't think he aligns himself so much. He has kind of humanist sympathies, I suppose, in certain directions. So he's never kind of clear cut about being, you know, he is kind of, if anything, sort of libertarian left, if you're going to nail it down. But he himself doesn't want to do that himself. And he does tend to be like a journalist, reactive to events as well.
I do agree, by the way. It's one of the most interesting things about him is that he criticizes the unrealistic sort of flighty, dreamy rubbish of the rest of the left. And he's absolutely right to do so. I just criticize his use of the word power and how he views the way that finance took over. I don't think that's right. But yeah, what he says, and yeah, what you said there, I think is totally true.
I reckon when we get to the hour mark, chaps, that'll be a good bookend, probably.
Okay.
We're about 3 minutes. I ran a thing earlier. How far are we going to get in? Or are we like 27 minutes? Something like that.
We started at 27 minutes in. So yeah. have we got another 27 minutes under our belt?
I think we've done at least half an hour. So it's not
okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just reminded of the Killer Mike lyric, Simon.
Go on.
Ronald Reagan was an actor, not an all a factor, just another puppet for the country's real masters.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting another visual contrast he's making, because that music he uses under there is a bit of John Carpenter piece called Mirror Image, which he's used a number of times. And I think he is using it directly as an illusion here, that you've got, do you remember we started the film with these images of people dancing in this kind of dreamy way? I think this is kind of Curtis, you know, using Saeed Qutb's metaphor for the kind of dreamy, kind of indifferent West. And this moment here where you've got these ructions going on in Afghanistan, and there's this mirroring of the kind of the Reagan revolution going on. You know, there's this sort of atheistic revolution in Afghanistan, and yet you're jumping to America. The mirror image of this, there's another kind of religious revolution. You know, the moral majority is in the ascendancy. And you've got the Reagan Democrats, the kind of aspirational classes who would usually vote progressive, are now going to the right. So it's kind of this interesting pivot moment that is a sort of reflection of the disquiet on both sides of the water.
In many ways, undone many years later by Donald J. Trump, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the Reagan Democrats went back to the Democrats, essentially.
Yeah. And for British viewers, the Reagan Democrats are kind of the equivalent of the Essex man for Thatcher at this time. They're what she would have called strivers, you know, sort of people who were working class who would have usually voted Labour. And in 1979, 1980, they flipped because they wanted to do better.
couldn't be happier. And I'm particularly happy today. We had a very good election last night, and the people came out in huge numbers to vote. And voted a new president, which is the people's choice.
I should have nuanced that a bit. So the story goes, they voted for Trump in 2016, went for Biden in 2020, allegedly, and then they went back for Trump in 2024. Is that right?
Mm. Whereas in 2020, they all had more votes somehow as well.
Well, yeah. But then the Rockefeller Republicans, who were the kind of libertarian elites who live in low-tax elites,
Don't be on the left of the Republican Party, though.
Yeah, they went back to the Democrats, basically, or they went for the Democrats rather than vote for Trump. Is that right? I think that's right. Would have all gone for Reagan in the 80s. I think that's right. This is the college-educated white women, blah, blah, blah.
And that's democracy in action. And I'm very proud of the people of the United States.
Oh, I was thrilled. I think the stock market will go up. Everyone will be happy. The economy is going to level off. Our international relations will become much more stable. I've worked very, very hard on the election in some of the phone banks, and all of my friends did. We were thrilled to pieces about it.
She's rocking the Joanna Lumley.
It's interesting that this, because this lead up, you know, we've talked about this period between 1970 and 1980. The neoconservatives, you know, they're this kind of offshoot from, you know, sort of dissidents within the Democratic Party. And there's this guy that Curtis refers to on the blog called Ben Wattenberg, and he produced an analysis of American voting patterns called The Real Majority. And he argued, Curtis says, that the country was now divided between a liberal elite preoccupied with cultural issues like race, sexual politics and abortion, and a vast forgotten hinterland who were un-young, un-poor and un-black. And he said the kind of median voter that was going to come into ascendancy at this point, what he calls Wattenberg's heroine, was going to be a 47-year-old housewife from Dayton, Ohio, who feared and despised the liberal elite. Harness that power, he said, and you can change the world. And this lady's probably not too dissimilar to that.
I've got a that from Ben Wattenberg in his book, The Good News. Oh, his article, I'm not sure. The Good News. Oh, anyway, he said, the non-Europeanization of America is heartening news of an almost transcendental quality.
Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, mad.
Yeah. What a statement that is.
Yeah, so he's a neocon. He's a proper neocon, and he's extremely pro-immigration.
I always have voted Democrat. So, you know, his times have changed now. So I'm not a baby anymore. So I had to make a change, and I made a change. And so the right man won.
President Reagan simplified everything for America. For 10 years, the country had been battered and torn apart by waves of economic and social chaos. Reagan set out to give the country a new sense of purpose. He took all the problems, even the most complex, and turned them into reassuring moral fables. And abroad, the world he depicted was one where, although good might struggle with evil for a while, in the end, goodness and innocence would triumph.
We have it in our power to begin the world over again.
It was a vision of the world that over the next 20 years would rise up to possess all of us in the West, both left and right. Conflicts that in the past would have been seen as political struggles were redefined. They became instead battles against dark demonic forces that threatened innocent people. And the role of we, the good people of the West, was to intervene to save those innocents. One of the places this dream began was Afghanistan. America was already helping the rebels who were fighting the Russians. But Reagan increased the aid massively and made it the symbol of his new vision. He even dedicated the space shuttle to the Afghan freedom fighters.
Just as the Columbia, we think, represents man's finest aspirations in the field of science and technology, so too does the struggle of the Afghan people represent man's highest aspirations for freedom. Accordingly, I am dedicating on behalf of the American people the March 22nd launch of the Columbia to the people of Afghanistan.
Yeah. That was Afghanistan Day, March 21st, 1987. He was signing in the Roosevelt Room at the White House, what's called Proclamation 5621. And interesting sort of that soporific pacifying music that was playing there is that burial track again called In McDonald's. Again, you know, sort of Reagan's ushering everybody through the golden arches.
And was it towards happiness. Was it literally the Taliban they were funding and helping? It was, wasn't it? It was the Taliban.
The Mujahideen at that stage, you know, the kind of the romantic freedom fighters who... came out in which was James Bond movie? Was it Living Daylights, wasn't it, that they came up in? The old romantic Mujahideen.
And having all got to know each other and fought together over there, they then got the band back together in a few other places since, right? Like Bosnia, yeah. Was one, I think.
That's it, yeah.
Chechnya, maybe.
A few Stinger missiles left over from their buddies in Langley, and, you know.
And Mujahideen means like soldiers of Islam, right? Or soldiers of God, like religious warriors.
Don't know the translation.
I think it means like, yeah, soldier for Islam sort of thing. And that was, you know, obviously this all honor given to them at this point, but many of these people went on to become Al-Qaeda, like what was called Al-Qaeda. Bin Laden was there. Obviously, we saw this in the Power of Nightmares.
They certainly, yeah, they something got elbowed out of the way. I mean, Abdullah Azzam was the kind of, you know, a leftover guy of the Mujahideen age, and then the foreign fighters came in and, you know, started to, hoik them into line under Zawahiri and Bin Laden.
And there was also this this guy who died in the early 2000s, I think, Ahmed Shah Massoud, was a kind of a legend in... the lost guy who could have been a good leader for Afghanistan but was killed, maybe murdered, maybe.
Yeah. So Curtis clearly doesn't like neoconservatism. He clearly doesn't like neoliberalism. He doesn't like, you know, what happened in the Blair era. Didn't like what happened in the Clinton era. Doesn't like Reaganism. Doesn't like Thatcherism. Mm. So what is it that he basically just wants the paternalism of like the 1950s and 60s?
I think he liked the sort of hopefulness and optimism of the post-war project, but I think he realized that liberal and left thinkers ascended into a kind of unreality. He talks about these simplified realities in which they kind of lost touch with you know how ordinary people think and feel, and so that unifying kind of ideology sort of, you know, just died away. And it, again, it's this theme of being haunted by the ghosts of these optimistic dreams that he often will talk about, which failed, and that nobody, especially on the left, who he really tears into, has come up with some kind of method or vision to solve that in some way, you know. But at the same time, he will, you know, he's not castigating, you know, the right per se. It's just that he has certain priors and assumptions, you know, about climate change and BLM and stuff that he holds on to.
So far he's had generally he's been quite, he's got a tendency to think that anything that comes from the right is disingenuous in some way, or is a lie, or is a cynical ploy being used against the rubes, something like that. Yeah. That's generally his framing, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. Sort of instinctive rejection of a conservatism. I mean, and Mark Fisher, who he was knocking about with, used to talk about this. They would sort of try to kind of kill the conservative in themselves. There was an automatic assumption that these things were bad, but there was also this hidden strain of kind of deep nostalgic reaction in them as well. So they kind of don't know how to square that circle.
And also, I mean, to complicate matters even further, it's often, very often, the case that they're right, that the likes of a Nigel Farage, or even the Tories under Thatcher, under whoever really, are cynical, are disingenuous, are dishonest, are playing the rubes for fools, are just kind of throwing meat to the gammon once in a while. Yeah. So this is the, I mean, we kind of find ourselves in kind of a similar place where it's like the stuff you're being served, you kind of know is tripe, basically.
Yeah. It's empty, so, you know, it's not going to lead to a kind of coherent and sustainable social milieu that's going to work. And countries are just tossed between these kind of, you know, avatars of optimism, which turn out to be busted flushes.
If I'm not mistaken, this is what we three and most of the viewers probably agree with him most of. He makes good critiques of the right and of the left, like of this shit right, obviously, the right that we don't support. And likewise of the left, we don't support very much about the left at all. But he does get it right most of the time. What I criticise is a bit of a different thing. But yeah, he's seldom more agreeable than when he's pointing out.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's Reagan and Thatcher. Sometimes it's stuff like the Randians, you know, like we saw in, was it The Trap? Which was also a very interesting critique. And he was right, you know, so.
I mean, I think it sounds like you feel some of his connections that he makes are a bit too sweeping at times, or a bit unnuanced. But broadly, yeah, this is why he is interesting, because he does exist at this junction. You know, which way, Western man? You know, how do you define yourself outside of these failed ideologies?
And they are failed, and they are wrong. He is right to go at them.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Where I disagree with him, I could go on about that all day, but it's the false left-wing view of the 20th century where Roosevelt was good and all this. I can't stand that stuff. But as a critic of the right and of much of the right and of most of the left, he's often bang on.
Yeah.
Just a couple of super chats. We'll remember this image of this bird wearing this, wearing a helmet, wearing the earmuffs. So we can remember. It's just past 1 hour in. Nice and easy to remember. But Giorgio Callahan says a game changer for chewy treats is frozen Cadbury's double deckers. It's chewy but frozen. Makes it crunch and then chewy. Nice. Don't knock before you try it.
Oh, I will. Absolutely will.
So, Simon, if you had a thick bar of chocolate, like you know, a Yorkie is actually
Yorkie
really
bar,
thick.
Yeah.
I don't like a Yorkie myself, but say if you had a Yorkie, you'd put that in the freezer.
I love chewing into things.
You want that as hard as possible.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, modern freezers aren't even really good enough to get them as implacably adamantine hard as I really want them to be. I don't like. I mean, I've only just recently started keeping butter outside the fridge. Because, you know, I used to keep in the fridge because I always hate butter that goes off. But then I found a Lakeland butter dish. This is my concession to middle classness, but it was in a charity shop, so it's okay. But it keeps the butter at a good temperature outside the fridge, even on a warm day. Okay. So you can have butter that's spreadable, but not curdling and going off.
Oh, I keep butter in the fridge, but I only use it for cooking, really. I don't eat breads.
This is the only show where you get these tips, isn't it?
I use ghee as well, but I don't keep that in the fridge for some reason. I
don't
know what the thinking is there. But
I found that because I like keeping a butter outside of the fridge. Mm. Sometimes it's too hot and it melts.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're forced. So what to do in that scenario?
Yeah.
And I found getting a little ramekin, you put it, stick it in the microwave for 10 seconds, softens up just enough to... So that's what I've had to do on occasion.
I will advocate the Lakeland butter dish. It's a bit built a bit like a an old thermos, where there's two sheets of metal slightly separated, so it doesn't conduct heat to the butter too directly, and the cold stainless steel keeps it at a good temperature, but not going rancid. So they're about 20 quid, but you know, I got mine for 2 quid in a posh charity shop.
Port Film Co-op says, accent challenge for Simon. Reform candidate apologises for watching an AA video.
you see, I don't know how to assimilate all of that information all at once. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm a failure. I can't do this. It'd be nice if we could find a Reform candidate who'd watch an AA. There's probably a lot of them who do actually watch this channel.
I've been having a go at Farage recently for his weak hand gestures.
Oh, yeah.
This is hardly peak tone, is it? Look at that.
It's flailing.
What does that tell you, Horace? Surrender.
Yeah.
I give up, well, Gov. You got me. It's well, so weak. You'd never see Blair doing that. Blair blades, claw, the steeple, Clinton thumb.
If we take on the Muslim vote, we're going to lose, as he said.
I really hate him. I really despise Horizon.
I've never heard of academic agent. Imagine him.
Did you see last week he pretended he hadn't heard of Homeland, when of course people around him will be telling him these Homeland guys are trying to cut into you. Like, it was so phony.
It's such a tiresome kind of boomer verbal comeback. You know, you mentioned something. Never heard of him. It's like sort of, they think it's a kind of gentleman's put down to say that you've never heard of someone who you probably likely have.
The power of that. Look at that.
Exactly. He's got the whole universe in his hands there.
I mean, you've got it. Look, the compressor. The compressor. Yeah. Oh, bloody adverts. Okay, let's
maybe he needs a session with Tone to get called in. Give him some pointers.
Weak body language from George O'Callaghan again. Jordan Peterson was a very public winner against the peak oppressive woke of 2016. He was the first winner seen by many. He's fallen off, but he was a key first step. Where is he? Where's old?
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.
Daniel Robinson says Saudis used the oil profits to buy tons of gold. The price doubled 6 months after the embargo. Post 1971, new reserve currency wasn't certain. As the US dollar devalued significantly in the 1970s versus the yen and the Deutschmark.
Now that is a damn good comment. That's trying to bring clarity to the bit that I was questioning earlier. That's really useful. So there was some doubt about what would be the reserve currency going forward. That's interesting.
Mr. Webster says, I would appreciate if you were to do a video on the silent generation born from 1928 to 1946. They are the oldest generation today alive and above the boomers and never get mentioned.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that a lot of the boomer bands that people think of were actually silent gen. Beatles were all silent gen. Ray Davis and the Kinks were silent gen. Keith and Mick were silent gen. Bob Dylan is silent gen. Pretty much every 60s star was silent gen. Clapton, I think. All of them.
Most Gen Xers like me have silent generation parents.
Silent generation and the generation before are the people who made the world that we blame on the boomers, right?
Yes. But if you watch my Boomer Truth Regime video, I spend most of the time talking about this. I actually spend most of the if you remember in my original deconstructing Boomer Truth video on the boomers are kids in that video. I focus on them when they're children. And in all of the videos, I focus on the programming they got when they were kids. So this is one of the ironies, because in the Gen X one, all of the cynical Gen X Darias are boomers. Bill Murray's a boomer. Yet he's the avatar of the Gen X Daria, right? But he's like all of the people who made the cynical stuff were boomers. And then later on, when I look at the millennials, I start with a clip of Take That. You're such a big star to me. Everything I want to be. But you're stuck in a hole. And I want you to get out. You know, when I talk about the millennials being egotistical and believing that, like, kind of always caught between believing they can do anything and, like, crippling, like, doubts. As epitomized by that Take That song. But of course, all of the people I quote in that video are Gen Xers.
Yeah.
So it's weird that the generation before makes the conditioning, makes the brainwashing that produces the next gen, if that makes any sense. So
you become the performing dog for the
It's weird. Which is probably a very bad reflection on the millennials, because the Zoomers I mean, are Zoomer parents millennials or Gen Xers? Kind of a combination of both.
Gen Xers usually.
Yeah, and it's probably a bad reflection on Gen Xers, but anyway. Cringe Walker says there's a funny theory that Al Qaeda is a rough translation of the Foundation of Asimov's books and a Sama like sci-fi, apparently. Well, that was another one of Curtis's big claims, that Al Qaeda didn't exist.
Or at least that, well, the notional Bond villain type network didn't exist, that it was just isolated groups of Islamists who formed under the rubric of Al Qaeda, because that was what the American RICO statutes kind of laid on them as a label. Al Qaeda, the base, they could become an organization that could therefore be prosecuted using RICO laws in the US. But there is obviously evidence that they actually did have, if you go back to Power of Nightmares, there was stuff coming out of places, Europe, Bosnia in the earlier 90s, that showed that they were formed as a sort of a better described network organization than Curtis. He wasn't saying they didn't exist as such, but he's saying that there's the idea that they were kind of an all powerful, living in hardened bunkers in mountains, with massive Donald Rumsfeld type, interiors and complex systems of, military and computer hardware was a nonsense. They weren't, but they did have linkages. And that, again, was initiated by this guy, Saeed Ramadan, injecting Islamism into Europe all the way back in the 60s and starting to form those networks.
On the Beatles being silent, Jim, by the way, George Harrison, I believe, was the youngest Beatle. I think when the Beatles started getting famous, he was only 17, right? Which is one of the reasons why he was quieter than the others, because he was literally a kid when they first started. And he was born in 1943. So he's safely Silent Gen, George Harrison, which means all the others must be too, because he's the youngest one. So I saw some people sort of claiming that Beatles were boomers. The other thing I just want to mention quickly, you know that song Shine by Take That that I was singing just now? In my head, that is a song by Gary Barlow, Robbie Williams, trying to get him back and trying to save his mate Robbie Williams. Do you remember Robbie Williams went a bit weird, didn't he?
That's a song from the Take That revival, isn't it? That's when Take That came back.
Yeah. If you listen to the lyrics, it could so easily be about Robbie Williams.
Because he was going a bit into the substances.
Well, because he's famously suffered with doubts. And look, you're such a big star to me, everything I want to be, but you're stuck in a hole, and I want you to get out, Robbie. You're trying to figure it out. All your anticipation pulls you down when you can have it all. You can have it all. This was the song came out when Robbie was in a down period after Angels and Millennium and all that,
Quite a long time after that. I would submit here that whether you're right or wrong, that did not warrant lyrical analysis.
Well, that's what I love doing, subjecting things that don't quite deserve it to this sort of it literally goes on to say in that song, and you might want to smile, don't you let your demons pull you down, because you can have it all. Come on. It's about Robbie Williams, I'm telling you. esoteric Take That analysis, you won't get it anywhere else.
I'll venture another claim. There are Take That lyrics that aren't about anybody. There may be, at least.
I've gone on to the Wikipedia background and release. The song is written in the key signature of E flat major. It later emerged that Robbie Williams was the subject of the track. Wow, look at that! They don't call him a world class scholar for nothing.
Literally, controlling the universe with his mind.
I didn't just edit Wikipedia as I was saying it either. Chris Rowe says, a mujahid, which is a singular of mujahideen, is a someone that does jihad. If you fight in the jihad, you are rewarded greatly. And if you die in the jihad, you are rewarded to something to be in the greatest layer of heaven and there are seven layers of heaven. I mean, we've all heard the stories that you're meant to like end up with like 24 virgins or something, isn't that right?
72 virgins or something.
Or 72 virgins.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Broman Henk says, so Curtis wants to suppress his inner conservative while we're all trying to suppress our inner liberal. Rather depressing, actually. Yeah, I mean, my dream is for all of that to go away and everybody would just be like, look, we all know we have been badly misrun by the elites, so let's like unite against them.
I think that's where he's at. I genuinely think that's where he's at.
You know, I made several videos at the start of the year along those lines, but thus far, only really old Charlie Downs has picked up that baton. There's not that many people speaking my language out there apart from Charlie and a few others. I think people are really committed to their tiresome kind of tribal, my party's better than your party. Whereas it's just like, fuck it. See them all as equally contemptible. And yet they have to be the vehicle through which we achieve anything. So it's like, well, it doesn't really matter if it's Labour or Reform or Tories or whoever. Just I want them to do the things they haven't done, you know. That's my current view anyway. But I suppose what makes it difficult is that some people in and around the place are paid off, aren't they? By one or the other of the parties, or they're an operative for a Reform, or they're an operative for somebody else. And so it's difficult to know who's like on the level or who isn't. Whereas one thing we can say about Curtis is that he doesn't seem to be on the payroll of any of the three political parties.
No. Rise above the clown show. That's the point.
Absolutely. All right, and I think that is it when it comes to Super Chat. Horace, where can people find you, sir?
I'm on Substack. I think some of the video, I'm halfway through writing my latest essay. Unfortunately, work gets in the way, but yeah, thanks.
Simon?
You can literally find me in about 4 hours' time at the Verdurin, or Verdurin, art space in Hoxton. I'm going down there for our friend Alexander Adams. He's launching his book, The Naked Spur, this evening at 7 prompt. That's at 2 Clunbury Street, London, N16TT. So I'm just going to hop on the motorbike and shoot down there now, and hopefully I'll get there in time for some fine wines and nibbles. And apart from that, I'm on Twitter, at Simon_Roberts. So, come and have a drink if you want to meet. I don't look like I do in my PFP, by the way, so prepare.
Are you, before you go to Hoxton, are you going to kind of get your moustache waxed and turned upwards? And just
I was going through a moustache waxing period recently, yeah. Yeah, sort of going almost for a Dick Dellingpole kind of, World War One style propeller moustache.
You'll fit right in Hoxton.
Yeah. Well, I'm slightly apprehensive, actually. It's interesting now that it's people like us establishing cultural outposts in Hoxton, no less.
Carry vinyl or a small vinyl record player with you. That's a real...
That's it. I'll have my record bag with me in my Trunk Records t-shirt so I blend in.
Playing Chap Hop. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Remember Mr. B, the Gentleman Rhymer.
Mr. B, the General Rhymer, and who was the other one? Professor Elemental.
They're really Elemental. Good track. Pretty good track, those,
All right. Pick up a course at the academic agency as well. I'm off to Swindon again tomorrow, third week in a row. Hopefully that'll be the last time in a while. Pick up the Trivium today, and I'll catch you all next there is my reply to Andy Edwards tomorrow morning, which you should all catch. But live, I'll be back next Tuesday. Bye, all.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.